It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy's here. Alex is here. Actually, Alex is at NAB in Las Vegas. Jason Snell is here. I'm at Mom's house, and we're going to talk about lots of interesting things, including M4 and AI. Is Apple prepared for the revolution? WWDC. What's going to be in the new iPads? And why you never want to be a showrunner with a show on Apple TV+. All that and more coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 917, recorded Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. Let a thousand dorks bloom. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple, and we are all over the map today. The only person, I don't know where I am. I'm in Grandma's house. Jason Snell is it? Are you at home or at
I'm
Mom's?
In my garage. This is real. This is not a green screen. I am in my garage. I'm back from the eclipse and now back just in my garage with my dog.
Was it really cool?
Yeah, it was great. Total eclipse is the best.
Life-changing.
I've seen it before. So this time when it happened, I was like, my old friend, we meet again. We're not so different, you and I. And anyway, it was really great. Yeah, awesome.
You know, some of the spookiness goes out of it when you realize it's just the moon casting a shadow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's
a weird shadow. I mean, the fact that one of the things people don't talk about enough is that because you're in a shadow, it's like a spot shadow. Everywhere around you in 360 degrees is sunset. So there's orange all around you because out there, there's still sun,
still
but not right in the shadow. Yeah. It's pretty wild.
That's cool. My head is big enough that I can kind of simulate that in case anybody wants to.
Stand in front of a light. Do it. Make the ants worship
in their home.
Yeah.
Andy Anatko's also here. In fact, I'm going to see Andy because he's just down the road a piece. I'm going to see him in a couple of days. Hey, Andy.
Yeah, we're going to get some clam cakes and chowder.
Oh, I'm so excited. I was hoping it was close enough to summer that maybe some of the clam cake places would be open. I think Dune Brothers is open. I'm going to be heading over there.
Yeah.
I love that. That's the best part of this area. Also here, but this time from Las Vegas, Alex Lindsay doing their NAB coverage for Office Hours. You're on the show floor.
We're on the show floor. We have our own booth. So, so we're in Central Hall and we're here at NAB, and this is the, you know, kind of the mecca for video production. So we've got three big halls full of toys.
Your assignment is to bring stuff home.
Yes. It's the most, I go to a lot of expensive places. This is the most expensive place that I visit every year. Yeah, I do the best I can not to spend too much money, but learning a lot. You know, it's been pretty amazing.
Can I just say that I love the room tone that you've got, and it just makes me wish you were instead of sitting down behind like a table microphone, you were standing up holding like a 1970s style, like, this is Shelby Scott reporting live from Gloucester.
I'm here in the Central Hall, Central Hall of the National Association of Broadcasters.
You know, with
things are tense today in the Senate chambers as Senate Bill 24, known as the Nasties Bill, is argued to a contentious and fractious Senate.
We should do a whole Mac break that way, just
with all the nostalgia going around. You know, my little Atari 400 and stuff. It'd be really cool if you had that Doonesbury backpack that had the satellite dish on it and the whole thing. And
I don't know. We can't really bring it over right now. We have a rig that looks very, it's nearly as complicated.
That would be awesome.
That's sitting over
there. Saw that. You showed us the.
It's gotten way worse. So much worse than it.
We are one year away from Alex doing an episode live where he's just walking and a drone is following.
Maybe
one year.
No, that's not as cool as the rig he showed off last week. He made me think that you're outfitted and functionally just like Edison Carter from the Max Headroom TV show.
Yeah.
That's nice looking.
That's my view of you.
And that's by the way, that box that you're looking at is not our normal feed. Back to you. You're looking at that in the Unreal Engine.
Yeah. So we basically, this was just Unreal, you know, I mean, Zoom released a bunch of things this week, but one of the things that they showed off at Zoomtopia, and now we're using it's kind of pre-release, this is Zoom joined the Zoom meeting that we're in, and I mean, not Unreal Engine joined the Zoom meeting, and we can then just map each person to different planes inside of Zoom. And so we can actually, we're not going to do it now, but we can animate all these frames.
Could we shoot at each other? That's the thing I'd
like. We could. I could actually, you know, we could actually set it up so that I could like fire at the different windows and there'd be like little holes in them and everything else. Yeah, it's all possible.
I actually feel like I'm in a kind of my own version of Fallout. I'm going through the cupboards to see what I can eat. I found some Bush's baked beans and I'm seeing, well, how old is it? Do you think I could? And then I know, but where's the can opener? There's no can opener. And, you know, there's stray dogs wandering by. I feel like I'm in the post-nuclear apocalypse.
You're in Fallout. That's great.
Yeah, it's great. And creaky chairs. Let us talk, ladies and gentlemen, about Apple, because it's so funny. We're not even through releasing M3 products, and now all the rumors are going crazy about M4. Maybe we'll even see M4 at WWDC because this is the AI flavored Apple Silicon.
No. I don't think that's true. I mean, Mark Gurman has a great report. I agree with you. There's the whole like M3, welcome, get out. Right, this happening now. Because it's like it was just here, and now you're talking M4. But I think people are running away from with themselves when they're like, "Oh, maybe it'll be a WWDC." I think Mark Gurman's report is pretty clear. It's going to happen toward the end of the year. It's going to be a 1-year cycle, so it'll come in October or November ish, just like the M3 did. And as for the report about AI, I want to just caution people. Mark Gurman's sources are amazing. He is the best scoop reporter working today and has been really for almost a decade, I would say now, from back when he was in college. However, there's also storytelling happening here. And when he talks about AI and he talks about how Apple's hoping to revive flagging Mac sales, that's narrative building. That's storytelling. He doesn't report that Apple is adding souped up AI features to the chips. He just says Apple is, by the way, adding AI features at WWDC. I think if this chip had like a whole brand new neural engine or many, many, many more neural engine cores and was like completely redesigned because they realized they needed to do more AI in their chips, I think he would have reported it. The fact is, Apple's been doing AI capability in their chips for ages now. And so the story is just, he's trying to say, hey, put it in the larger context of, hey, you know, this summer, Apple is also going to talk about AI software and these chips will be powerful. But this is not like a magic chip full of AI juice. It's just an M4 and Apple's already, trust me, machine learning hardware is not Apple's problem.
Yeah. And also, like, we're asked when Google announces, hey, we've got this new Tensor AI chip that we're putting on all our phones. That's the result of them working on AI and shifting to AI for 10 years. Apple probably has not had enough runway on this idea to say we're building silicon specifically to run our AI models and to serve the AI needs of macOS and iPhone OS. Not yet. So I'm certain. Yeah, exactly. I mean, at this point, I'm sure that affects the metrics that they use when they decide on performance versus power, like power consumption, heat. They're probably thinking that, okay, we are now willing to increase the thermal envelope of our chips. We're now willing to have these things draw more power if it means that we can go from 10 to 11 when we need to run a whole bunch of stuff on device, because that's going to be the thing that distinguishes Apple's AI from everyone else's AI. Whereas with Google, they are very, very, they want to make sure you know that amongst the portfolio of models that they have a low power device that will be able to run, a low power model that can run entirely locally on device without connecting to Google servers or anything. Apple is the one that's going to say, we might have a model that can do some stuff in the cloud, but mostly we are going to have you trust that whatever data that you're interacting with our AI is going to be staying private to your device, whether it's a Mac, whether it's a Power Mac, whether it's a Pro Mac, whether it's a Pro iPhone, whatever.
I guess it makes sense to me that Apple, okay, this is, talk about storytelling, Jason. This is what the story I told myself.
A prophecy tells us the story of it.
Well, what I'm thinking is, we saw this with the M3, as much as we expected, even on a new, 3-nanometer node, we didn't see the biggest performance jumps that maybe I thought I was going to see, others thought. And maybe Apple is now to the point with their chips of its flavors, not performance, that they're going to start looking at. Is that?
We definitely saw that with the M3, and you're right. The M3 is not like the M2 and the M1 in the sense that the M3 Pro chip is different from the Max chip.
The interconnects are different, right?
Yeah, but it used to be a chop, basically. So there was like the Pro chip and the Max was just like more. And then this M3 Max is different. And the M3 Pro is actually a little bit less because I think they want to make it more portable to hit a sweet spot kind of on the low end. Not the low end of I guess mid-range we could call it, but like you right, your lower end MacBook Pro, but you want a little more than the M3. It is, but it doesn't advance like the M3 Max, which really got a lot faster. So I think you're right. I think Apple is only going to be able to make incremental updates most of the time because that's just the way it works, right? So every M gets whatever 15% faster or something, but what they can also do is mix and match with their components. So like if they do a new neural engine core, which they did, I think last time, it will be a lot faster. But they can also choose how many of those cores to put on, how many GPUs to put on, how many they've got these different processing blocks. So for example, in the Pro versions of the M1, they had processing blocks to do video encoding, to do Apple ProRes encoding. And now, and it's in the base M2 and M3 as well. So that's their other part of this, right? Is it's not just like how fast is a core. It's like how fast are the cores? Yes. How fast are the GPU cores and the CPU cores? How fast is the neural engine? How many of each of them? What's the balance? And that does allow them to do that thing where they're like, it's like a chef making a few different versions of the same recipe, right? I'll make this version for the down low version, and this one will go to the mid-range, and this will go to the high end, and they can experiment with those variations. So the one thing where we might actually see Apple's interest in AI in a future version is, for example, ramping up the GPUs or ramping up the neural engine cores. But they can do that, right? Like that's the kind of stuff where they're mixing and matching that I think you'll see more of.
And I think the danger really is you know, confusion. You know, for the person who's buying, you know, there starts to be like, well, what chip do I get? You know, and you know, usually it's been like, oh, I get the new one. The new one's going to be this much faster than the old one. And if it starts getting into, I got to figure out which one, and I need a, you know, spreadsheet to figure out which one I want. This gets back into all the trouble that Apple had in the 90s, where it wasn't simple anymore.
Too many SKUs.
You just couldn't figure out right. What you needed and how you needed it. So I think that's going to be that's a challenge that they're going to have to work through. I also think that, you know, with all of the AI stuff that they're talking about, I think Apple's approach is going to be much different than everyone else's. So it'll be really interesting to see how they roll that out. It's probably not going to look like ChatGPT. You know, there's going to be this probably some kind of federated solution that the most important things are to stay on your device, and then other things that are less important are probably sent out to the rest of the to Google or somebody else.
I do hope that they're giving that a lot of thought, though. Remember that. We all love the cardinal differences in philosophy between Apple and Google, where Google can do so much more for you in certain areas because it's collecting so much information. Apple is not quite so savvy about being able to divine a solution for you that works across applications and across structures, but it is keeping your privacy sacrosanct. That's the cardinal opinions that differ, but you can pick which one you get. And with AI, it might be the exact same thing, but also a bit of a problem. If Google solutions from Google, OpenAI, whatever, are saying, well, no, we are putting a lot of stuff in the cloud. We are doing a lot of the processing off of your device, but that means that anytime we need a gajillion cores to make this solution, to make it happen fast. Anytime we want to make a solution that does not burn up your device's battery, all it needs to do is transmit something via Wi-Fi or broadband, and then it will simply spit out a result back. If Apple is limited to just what their own handheld CPUs can do, that's going to put them at a disadvantage for a suite of features that is, I think, is really going to speak to a lot of people.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about the confusion thing, because I think Alex is right, and we've always mentioned the four quadrants. I do think, though, that Apple has done a very good job in the Apple Silicon era of keeping it clear. We can all, as nerds, talk about how many CPUs, how many GPUs, all of that kind of stuff. But in the end, it's the M whatever, the Pro, the Max, and the Ultra. And so it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's good, better, best, and you can't afford it. And they go in very specific products, and that hasn't really changed. They added a higher end SKU to the Mac Mini in version 2, but like the M3 goes in the MacBook Air, so will the M4 and the iMac, right? That's where it goes. The MacBook Pro spans because there are low-end ones and high-end ones. Like, there are, the Mac Studio has the high-end two chips, right? So I think there is some discipline there that is good, because it's absolutely true that this consumers, you know, they don't care. And even pros on one level kind of don't care. They just want to know, like, give me the right target to shoot at, and say, like, Macs, like, as a Mac Studio user, like, M3 or 4 Max is going to be my next purchase, right? It's like, Max is the sweet spot when I make an investment to do all my video encoding and stuff like that. It's just, so I think they've been pretty good at that for something that could be, like, we don't talk about clock speeds, and
right.
We don't really even talk about the cores, right? I mean, they have very limited core variations on their site. They really keep it simple, which is good, because it gets real complex real fast.
Otherwise. Yeah, people who read the German report might be surprised to find that, oh, wow, the G4, the next generation, and the first, according to, like, his report, the first devices that will use the M4s, and the ones that will be coming out in late 2024, wow, they're putting it first in the desktop, in the iMac. They're putting it first in what's described as a low-end MacBook Pro, but it's the hottest news. Like, well, no, it's not really, because, like Jason says, it's not so much... The M4, M3, M2, M1, that's the basic design of this piece of silicon, and how they package it is how they turn it into a Pro, into a Max, into a budget affordable and unobtainium, by putting so much of these cores on a single die to have them communicate with each other in flea whisker lengths of copper. That's how they actually get that performance, not by saying, well, this M is one more, isn't it? Like, well,
yeah, but that's how consumers are going to look at it. I mean, yeah. An M4 is one better than an M3, isn't it?
And Intel is creating the exact same confusion. We all think of, oh, this i3, i5, i7, i9. Yes, but which i3, which i5, yeah. Which
Intel's
i7?
Intel's really muddied the waters, yeah. As has AMD. Yeah. It's very hard to know what you're getting.
Also, we already just did this, right? Last fall, they announced the iMac, which was an M3, and they announced the MacBook Pro, which was M3. M3 Pro and M3 Max.
All right, let me throw a monkey wrench into this.
Oh,
you
no.
didn't mention the iPad.
Okay.
Is it going to be an M4 iPad?
No, the next generation of iPads is coming out, and it'll be an M3, and there'll be an M4 iPad.
It will be for sure an M3, right?
Oh, okay. I mean, people run away with this. Mark Gurman's report's pretty clear. The M4 is coming at the end of the year.
End of the year, not any sooner. Okay.
No sooner.
Okay. You know, because up till now, the iPhones got the latest chip, but there was, as you say, it was different sprinkles and no gummy bears.
Yeah. So what Gurman's report, there's a detail in there that I think is interesting, which is he says Apple's goal has been to get Apple Silicon on the M series, right, for the Mac, on an annual cycle like the iPhone.
Right.
And it sounds like that. Which saves a lot, right? Because it means that they design a core and it's instantly like that generation ships with that core. Whereas before we were like, okay, every 18 months, is this on last fall's core or is it on next fall's core?
If they did
or what's
that,
going
they
on?
Could drop M3-4 and just call it 2024, 2025.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just like the A series, right? They increment the A series every year for the iPhone. So it sounds like this is their platonic ideal is every fall there's a new core generation and it includes the A whatever and the M whatever and off we go. And that seems to be what they're doing.
Yeah. So, okay. Okay.
For what it's worth, I mean, I've been talking about, I'm finally going to be able to upgrade my Mac Mini to like Apple Silicon, and I keep putting it off with every new iteration, and I'm not going to wait until the spring of 2025 to wait for an M4 based Mac Mini. I'm going to get some flavor of M3 Max or M3 Pro this year, because it's not going to be that big of a difference between the M3 and the M4.
Now, maybe I misremembered this, but didn't Gurman also say, though, that the new iPads will be the first generation of this, is it the 3N node, the new node? And isn't that, I mean, I am really muddying the waters.
The chip design, right?
I don't remember
that report, but the node isn't the chip design. There's some speculation that they might be on the new node for the Ultra, that the M3 Ultra might actually be on a different process at TSMC, but now we're really down in the weeds, right? But that would be like, but it would still be using the M3 generation of cores. And so that, you know, the process is not the same as the chip generation.
Well, and I think that for the iPad, that's the real place where I don't know if people will know or care. I mean, they're going to want something that's faster, but I have to say that for most applications, I have one iPad that's 2 years old and one iPad that's 3 years old. I didn't buy last year's iPad because I didn't think it was, what am I going to do with it? Like, what is new? And this is the biggest challenge that Apple has with the iPads. What is new that's enough new that I'm going to buy a new one? Because, you know, my kids just finally stopped using one, that the very original iPad Pro, you know, like, I mean, not iPad Pro, or iPad, no, the very original 12.9, and it was working perfectly well. I mean, Apple's almost overbuilt them for a long time.
They're all overbuilt.
Well, and the issue is that the software, they are getting better from iPad to iPad. The problem really is that there's not enough, you know, Apple and others aren't pushing the hardware, the software hard enough to actually use the hardware, you know, use the hardware. And that's the issue.
That's a tale as old as time. Let me read the paragraph from The Verge this is what consumers are going to read, not Mark Gurman, because that's paywall. They're going to read this, and this is going to confuse the hell out of them. This is The Verge. The M4 chip will come in at least three different tiers, including the entry-level M4 chip codenamed Donin, the mid-tier Brava, and the highest-performing Hydra chip, according to Bloomberg. Apple reportedly will add Donin to the entry-level MacBook Pro, its MacBook Airs, and the lower-end Mac Mini. Meanwhile, Bloomberg says Apple reserved the mid-tier Brava for the higher-spec MacBook Pros, Mac Minis, and Mac Studio, while adding the top-tier Hydra to the Mac Pro.
Yeah, I mean, aren't code names fun? Everybody loves code names.
This is the worst.
But I mean, you can just do it in your mind. Donin is M4, and it sounds like Brava is M4 Pro and maybe also M4 Max, and whatever it is, Mecha Godzilla is M4 Ultra, and that's it. Like, and it's going to go where you want. Like, there's nothing here, right? This is it's storytelling. It really is Mark Gurman showing off that he knows the names of the code names of the products.
Right.
That's what
I
it is.
Think it's
and
not
fine,
important.
Good credit to him, but nobody else should care.
Yeah, you should really just buy. And the product says what it is. You know what you're getting. If you're getting a Mac Mini, you know what you're getting.
It only matters if you're in a product like the Mac Mini or the MacBook Pro, where you have chip options, right? And they are more expensive, and you can go all the way from the M3.
But even then,
up
you can
the
go
M3
by price.
Pro.
You just go by price.
But you could extrapolate from the price that you are getting more. It's 100% true.
I'm getting the cheap one. I'm getting the expensive one. I do think it's interesting. And again, this is not coming from Apple, but the drumbeat is very strong. The WWDC is going to be the AI WWDC, that Apple's going to focus on AI. Apple really hasn't had much of a story with AI, you know, except for, you know, research papers about Ferret and things like that. I feel like this is, I can't decide whether Apple has decided to let the AI pass them by. They're probably not sure themselves. They're not going to let AI pass them.
No, absolutely not. They are kind of visibly on the back foot because AI has been, they've used words like machine learning a lot, particularly with computational
photography. For years.
And little things like that. Yeah. They haven't been able to show anything. But again, the suites of AI driven features, a lot of them are, again, so compelling to so many users. It's not about, hey, look, I've got the new GPT-4 Pro LLM model running on my whatever. It's like, hey, look, I've got 500 emails and it was able to summarize pretty much and prioritize these things for me immediately. That's the sort of stuff that's compelling. Circling a person in a photo you've just took on your phone and shoving them over to the right a little bit and having the background hole filled in with a completely convincing replacement of trees, grass, and sky. That's really compelling.
Apple those places are owned by Microsoft and Google, right, respectively. But, I mean, owned big time.
No, well, but Apple can get back on that horse. But this is WWDC is going to be the AI WWDC, because Apple really has to, after they had a lot of months to put this presentation together, to make sure that analysts, investors, everybody knows that we're not going to get blackberried by AI. We are not going to be the company that keeps our faith in, well, touchscreen, people don't want to type on a piece of glass. I think that our business model is completely still in tune with what customers want. No, they're saying that, no, we don't have a touchscreen yet, but we have stuff to show off, and we are clearly moving towards that place. This is AI is not going to sink the company. It might be one of several factors that kind of make it a hot potato investment for the next year or so. So this is why they're going to make that sales pitch.
There has to be some concern in Cupertino, though. Mac sales fell in the last fiscal year 27%. For the first time in some years, Samsung is the number one smartphone manufacturer. Apple's iPhone sales are down a significant amount.
That's particularly bad, by the way, because they're down 9.6% year to year, despite the global market for smartphones being up 7.8%.
That's not good.
And particularly in markets like China, where they are just having so much problems holding on to that reputation as, no, we are the elegant, expensive brand that everybody wants, as opposed to, well, no, we're Huawei. We're the homegrown example that's absolutely in tune for your local market. We're not someone from across the planet who's just taking guesses as to what we want. So this is, as I said, a lot of this has to be, I can't think of another WWDC where the subtext of, please, analysts, please don't keep undervaluing us. Please don't make it difficult to make us to maintain us as an investment. Again, they're not desperate, not this year, not by any stretch of the imagination. But this is the sort of stuff that wipes hundreds of millions of dollars off of valuation very, very easily with just one bad press release, just one bad announcement that they didn't have any control over. And they're going to be trying to mitigate that over the next several months.
I still don't know. I mean, I don't know how much iPhone users are like worried about whether their hardware has AI. I mean, we've got ChatGPT. We've got a lot of these other services available to us. The fact that it's not embedded into that system may or may not be that. I just don't know if they're a hardware company with people who are probably not going to change sides anytime soon. A lot of their sales are going down in China, not in a lot of other places. So it may be down overall, but I'm not sure that the AI story is really what is affecting people buying their phones. And I don't think it would be that way. People were talking about Apple being behind on 5G, and they finally did 5G after, I don't know, being 2 years behind, and I don't know if it moved the needle. I mean, it didn't make any difference on my phone, except that the calls aren't as good.
I think we don't care so much about the stock.
I just think that everyone was like 5G, 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 and then we, you know, got 5G and didn't make any difference. You know, like, you know, and Apple didn't rush, and if they still had LTE, my phone would probably work better.
Well, I don't know. 5G storytelling earlier, right? But the fact is, the one place where it matters is someplace like the stock market and like investment. And if you care, which again, I do not care. I don't think we care about the stock market and about Apple.
I bet you people at Apple care. Yeah,
but people at Apple do care, and the shareholders care, and so it is important in that way. I also want to say, just we can get like, are there some flashing warning lights in Cupertino? There absolutely are. That said, we can overstate some of this drama. Mac sales are basically back where they were pre-pandemic. But in the meantime, between then and now, there was an enormous influx of Mac sales. So the Mac install base is actually way larger than it was. I would actually argue it's kind of amazing that Mac sales went back to the 2019 level, because they sold a lot of brand new Macs for like 3 years. Those people probably aren't upgrading. So they're still managing to not take a nosedive after that incredible high in 20 and 21. And on the iPhone side, we can talk about it. And yes, there is softness in the iPhone. But I'll also point out the holiday quarter iPhone sales number was the second highest iPhone sales number of all time, down from the previous quarter. So it is also a case where sometimes Apple's heights get so high that when they lose 5% or 8%, everybody freaks out in Wall Street. I get why. And those warning lights should be coming on. But let's also get real here. Apple's still selling more iPhones than they were 3 years ago and probably 2 years ago. So it's not like, but if you're at Apple, you're paid to worry about what's going to happen 3 years, 5 years out, right? Because they're designing those products. They absolutely should be certain. I'm also not convinced that any sales are being lost because people are like, oh, gee, I don't know what Apple's going to do about AI. I feel that that's a little bit of an inside industry thing at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do agree with that. But the thing is, these things are cumulative. It's like it's like putting stress on a piece of metal that you can get away with it for years and years and years. And then suddenly you have to shut down the entire bridge for 5 years and rebuild it from the top to bottom, because now it's just so stressed, it's about to collapse. Again, Apple is not in that position right now, but there comes a point where the iPhone users will be in the worst case scenario, there will be a point where the iPhone users are the ones who are sort of looking over the shoulder at a friend of theirs who has an Android phone who says, wow, you were able to make that photo edit really quickly. Why doesn't my phone do that? Hey, wow, you and I were at the same meeting. You're going home at 5 p.m. I'm still processing all of this data that needs to be turned into action items and figures and updates. And you're going home right now and I'm still working on this. Why can't my phone? Why can't my operating system? Why can't my desktop do that?
That's why the warning lights are on.
Exactly.
You're describing a world where Apple does nothing and Android moves forward. I think that's not going to happen.
Well, no, that, I'm just reframing it as, yes, it's true that most users don't care about AI. They don't care about language models. They don't care about OpenAI versus Gemini. However, they do care about, wow, a modern phone, I expect that a modern desktop and a modern phone can do these things. Apple has to make sure that their phone and their desktop can do those things as well. And
sure,
what's going to power a lot of those features is going to be AI.
And when we're talking about warning lights and the future, that's absolutely right. But when you're tying it to Apple's current phone sales or Mac sales, it's wrong, I think. Well, I think that's the difference, is if we talk to the future, sure. But I do not think there are people who are like, oh, geez, I'm going to abandon the iPhone now because I don't know. I really want this. I just don't think that that's happening in any appreciable numbers. But
also
if I was at Apple, I would not be complacent because I think that it is a big danger for the future, which is why they're freaking out and doing AI this summer, apparently. We'll see how good they did.
Just quickly, no one in this conversation is making that point, just to make that really, really clear. But when you talk about analysts are the sort of people who do worry about what moves are going to be made with a $100 million investment at a time in the next quarter. And a lot of that is based on faith. A lot of that is based on guesswork backed by millions of dollars of spreadsheets. But these are the things where if Apple trips up, that can wipe out tens of millions of dollars of valuation in a day. And hopefully, and it will almost certainly be brought back in about a week. But in the meantime, there are a lot of investors and a lot of boards that are like, I really wish that Apple hadn't lost tens of millions of dollars of value, because that really screws up what I can do with my money in this quarter. So this is there are a lot of different variables.
I think Apple methodically is doing the kind of buybacks and all kinds of other things to keep the stock moving forward. And I think that that's there. But I think also Apple has a cash, position set up specifically so they don't have to sit there and worry at every moment about, what people think of what they're doing. I think it's a much longer term process. And I think that Apple always knew that this day would come when people stopped buying iPhones at a record rate every single quarter. And that's why there's focus so much on services.
Yeah, and I think the real threat from AI, it's hard to tell. This is reading tea leaves. But the real threat from AI is probably not on your computer or on your phone. It's an adjunct device. Rewind.ai just announced their limitless clip. Did you see? You probably all saw that. Which is a really interesting device that does not require an iPhone, does not use...
The question is, am I going to buy that and then not use my iPhone?
I think that's what I'm saying is that AI may not be so tightly tied to the phone or the computer, that what people end up, and Apple really should have a position in this as separate from the phone and the computer. What people may very well end up doing is using AI devices. You know how Humane just got slammed by Marques Brownlee and everybody's all upset about that. I think we all saw that coming. I saw the AI pin, the Humane pin, and I was thinking, should I buy that? And I immediately said no. I did buy, however, the Limitless clip, because it records everything, synopsizes it, writes notes for you. It's an off-device thing. And I think that it's hard to predict where the future of AI lies. Who knows? It could be in the dumps for all I know. But I think it's Apple's position. They need to be working. I wish they'd worked as hard on an external AI device as they did on the Vision Pro, to be honest with you. I think that's going to be where you really want to be.
I still think that Apple tends to hang back, watch, a lot of, a lot of times, I always think of Apple as a little bit like, I'm a Steeler fan, and we had this running back, Le'Veon Bell, and what made him so good was you'd watch him stutter step going into the line. He didn't just barrel into the line. Like, he's sitting there waiting for his moment to open. And I think Apple does this a lot. They look at a technology, we everyone wrings their hands that Apple's behind on this and they're behind on that, and then they put something out, but oftentimes it's a year or 2 years behind everybody else, and so there's a bunch of wringing of hands for a couple of years, and then they put something out, and it's the Apple version of that, and sometimes it's not even as good as some of the other ones. I'm not going to purport that everything there, but it fits into the overall experience that an Apple user expects.
Yeah. We just have to hope that there's long enough runway that they can actually pull that sort of thing off. Again, with AI, you have to have such a long-term investment. You have to plant your crops 10 years before you can harvest. And if 5 years from now, everybody's talking about how, I don't think the phone is going anywhere because it just fulfills so many functions, including taking wonderful 4K videos and beautiful multi-megapixel photos in any situation. That's one of the reasons why the phone isn't going anywhere.
What they said about point-and-shoot cameras about 5 years ago. Well, anywhere. What else would you do?
I don't think that's equivalent. But what I'm getting at is that. It could be just as simple as, again, 5 years from now, being able to tell your personal assistant, hey, Bob and Julia send me reports every Thursday and Friday, set everything up so that every Monday I get an analysis of this, incorporating everything from our financials and everything from the Reuters news service, and prepare a report and a slide deck that's ready for me every Monday at 9. And it just says, okay, I'll do that. And that's the sort of thing 5 years from now that people are going to say, well, why you're actually open? What is Keynote? What is that app? You're building a presentation with an app with a keyboard. Okay,
that's the point. Is that things are changing in a very unpredictable way, very rapidly. And I don't think you can look at the history of Apple and Apple's playbook and say, well, that's going to work forever. I don't know if it is. I think it's very easy Apple could lose this, but they have the pieces right now with the AirPods, for instance.
Yeah.
They have the pieces. I think that, honestly, that's putting AI in the phone or in the Mac or in the chip is maybe not the way to be looking at it.
This is what I was thinking about the Humane Pin, which you mentioned earlier. Is I wonder if the problem with the Humane Pin isn't just it's a product with a bad premise, because I feel like they tried to at least put lipstick on a pig and say, you don't need your smartphone.
You don't need a phone.
They couldn't afford to integrate with smartphones, or they couldn't do it.
But think about the palm of your hand. That's all you need.
Yeah. I mean, people love their smartphones, so I think it was stupid, but I think maybe it was out of desperation that they did that. But I remember a classic Steve Jobsism, which is your thing is not a product, it's a feature. And I think sometimes about the AI pin that's what it is it's a feature. The question is, does Apple, for example, need to be the world's leader in AI models, or they're going to go out of business? Or is it more like, does Apple need to be a leader in having products that work with the good AI models and do the stuff that people want to do and succeed? Because you're right, Leo, when I think about the AI pin, I start to think, well, Apple's doing some AI stuff right now. Is it possible? The great Verge video talks about this too, where the Verge reviewer, oh God, now I've forgotten his name, David Pierce.
Yeah.
Such a great video, such a great review. And he says, like, my cellular Apple Watch is already more capable than the AI pin is at a lot of things. And then you think, and if there's a new Apple Watch in the next year or two that has a good enough processor that can do some on-device ML processing plus cloud querying and bring it all back. And then you've also got AirPods that can hear your world around you, and maybe some other devices that Apple is building. You know, if Apple does that right, then what Apple is all about is integrating their hardware and ecosystem into a world where there are cloud data sources and there's AI processing happening. And like, they don't necessarily have to do it all, but they do. Like, there are opportunities because they've already got the hardware and the hardware skills to put those things in our ears and on our wrists and in our pockets.
Yeah,
and
to put it in the terms Alex would understand, Le'Veon Bell has to skate to where the football is going.
Oh,
isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think that the thing is that again, I think Apple's got a lot of time. You know, I don't think they have a lot of time.
That's the point. I think they need to be on it now.
I think that they've been on it probably for a little
while. I hope so.
So yeah. I think us assuming that Apple turned it on in the last 2 years is probably, they've probably been thinking about AI for a little while. They probably
had a couple hundred employees. But Siri's the best they could do at that.
No, I think the Siri. I think Siri is the. I mean, like for instance, a good example is for me Siri. I don't use Siri almost at all, and the main reason I don't do it is I have a whole bunch of Apple devices, and they all light up every time I say something. You know, and so I just turn it off everywhere. You know, like and so I. You know, and I. And the problem, you know, thing is that I don't use Siri very much, and I still love my Apple products. You know, and so the thing is it's not like I in the kitchen will ask Siri some basic things like the weather and everything else. I don't feel like I need, like as an Apple user, I guess I don't feel like I need that anytime soon.
We're talking about the future.
I know. What I'm saying is that it's, I think that Apple, number one is I think that we should probably assume Apple has been thinking about AI for at least a decade. And that we should, so they, it's not that they haven't been paying attention. They just haven't released anything yet. That's a big, big difference there. And number two is that I think that, but I don't think it has to be, I don't think, they can talk about WWDC. I don't think it's that much of a rush. I think that they have to be working on it. I think that they have to be figuring out what they're going to do. But I don't think they have to do something this June that's going to suddenly move the needle. If, you know, and I think that the, you know, because the number one thing every year that people use to decide what phone they're going to buy is what is their camera doing? Like, you know, like that is like when you look at every time they ask someone, like, how do you choose a new phone? Like, and most of us, when we're waiting, looking at a new iPhone release, we're like waiting for them to get to the camera. And they put it at the end because they know that as soon as we find out what the new camera is, we'll decide whether we're upgrading or not. You know, and so the thing is that I think that that's going to be the case probably for at least a couple more years. And I think that, I do think that Apple absolutely has to have, you know, figure out how they're going to, and again, I think it's a federated solution. I think that they're going to do things that interrogate the content that you have on your phone privately, very effectively. Tell me, hey, I had an email to Andy, 2 years ago, and it was about, you know, what kind of lights he was using. Can you find that email for me? You know, and have it come up in those kinds of natural, like, I need to do that. That's the kind of thing you want to keep on your phone. And then integrating with other things that allow you to do the higher scalable and riskier things, and making sure that those are integratable into your experience. And I think that that's a much better solution than trying to boil the ocean. I'm not saying that Apple shouldn't be worried about it, and I think that they are, and I think they've been thinking about it for a while. I just don't think that they have to do something. There's not a lot of rush that's required. I don't think people are making phone decisions about it this year or even next year.
Yeah, and also we all know that the iPhone market is, you can't really judge it or predict it the way that you talk about Samsung or any other manufacturer. The iPhone audience is a very special audience. It takes Apple really has to stick its thumb in a user's eye in order to get people to even consider walking into a phone and not just deciding what new iPhone am I going to buy. But the only thing I'm worried about is that, like, a lot of the AI features you described, they're great, they're useful, but you're making a faster horse, and other people, even startups, might be creating jet engines. They might be creating rockets, things that, no, it doesn't do search, local and internet much better and much faster. It is the answer to the question of why aren't digital assistants more useful. Like, it's as much as I like digital assistants, as much as I see the potential in it, I acknowledge that most people are using it to turn lights on or off and set timers, and that's pretty much it. But that's the failing of imagination. The I've always just loved the potential of every single circumstance in which I want an absolute no touch, no look interface that can do 50 to 70% of the things that I need a phone or even a desktop to do, just as simply while I'm in the kitchen, not setting a timer to make sure that I take out my roast in time, but saying that, oh, by the way, I want to take a look through my Chrome bookmarks, find everything that's related to Mac news and put it in a Google Docs spreadsheet and organize them by topic. And if I've bookmarked something several times, put that higher up on the list. And actually, if you could give me a heat index of how much other news organizations are talking about that, that'd be great too. And while I'm drying the dishes, like, now on my smart display, there is a picture of that spreadsheet. That's the sort of stuff. That's not a faster horse. That's a rocket ship. And again, I agree with everything that's being said, that Apple does not have to pull a rabbit out of its hat this year. But that's why when we talk about WWDC, all they have to do is make sure that they know that AI is part of the conversation with every large, serious tech company's keynote of their strategy. They just have to make sure that if they're not necessarily saying, here's what we're going to be doing in late 2024, 25, 26, but they have to, that they can no longer pretend that this is something that, oh, well, here's a research project that we've done. We've published a paper, and here's a way that we've done to enhance facial recognition. They have to say, here is investments we're making in AI, not just any AI, but Apple's version of AI, which we think we can bring great things to the table for.
It's what's really clear is that the stakes for June are very high for Apple, and that WWDC is going to be hotly anticipated and watched with interest.
I don't think it's that. I think if next year or the year after, I think is a big deal from an AI perspective. I think that they have a lot planned for WWDC. I think if they show some stuff, but I just don't think
they don't need to show anything. They need to show that they get it.
That's it. That's it. I think that's where the stakes are high. Alex is right. This is going to take years. And if they just ship a bunch of stuff this fall and then walk away, they will have failed. But I think the stakes are high because the narrative is important, because telling the world and Wall Street that you are on it, which honestly, if you listen to statements Tim Cook has been making for the last 4 months, it's always like, yep, we know AI, we're on it, we're doing stuff, you'll see, right? Like, they are aware that people want to hear them say, we have a strategy and here's what it is. And then they have to execute. But Alex is right in the sense that this is not going to be a thing where they're going to be able to announce some stuff and ship it and solve it this year. It's an ongoing process, but they do need to show their commitment and that they get it and that they understand that it's important.
And they've been releasing some white papers.
A touchy-feely.
Yeah, and they've started to release a couple of white papers that's kind of like, hey, you know, we have some smart people here. You know, like, there is a little bit of a hinting towards that as well.
Yeah, I bet that everyone who works on AI at Apple, they're suddenly like around October, maybe even August of last year, they noticed that, hey, wow, now we've got like actual name brand creamer in the fridge in the break room instead of like the Walmart brand.
Ooh, the good stuff is here now.
The mechanics of AI are well known. It's not, there are no real secrets, in at least in LLMs. Maybe there's something else.
Well, the challenge
has been saying lately, LLMs are a dead end. It's interesting. But the point is, Apple's a product company, and research papers or an R&D division working on LLMs is what we're talking about. And Apple needs to productize AI and needs to be at the forefront of that, or they will be eclipsed very rapidly. Honestly, that's just the way the world works. Innovations are coming.
I think that Apple needs to also figure out how they do it inside of their ecosystem. How do they protect user privacy? How do they, you know, deliver, you know, solid results? How do they, you know, or be able to tell you how solid those results are? So there's a bunch of things that Apple has to think about that other folks are just kind of like,
that's why Apple hasn't done anything yet, because AI safety is an unsolved problem.
Right. And so I think the only time I start thinking I need something other than an app than my Apple devices is when they start, you know, when Apple does an update and I've got a bunch of things that aren't working on my phone, or I got a bunch of things. I'm like, what I pay for is everything's working. I don't care that it's on the cutting edge. I just don't want to think about.
I agree.
Why is this hanging up?
A rug pull in a couple of years. All of a sudden, everybody could be saying, oh, forget it. Look what this is doing.
Maybe.
I mean, there's real danger to Apple. I think in the long term, there's some existential danger to Apple and the idea that, like, if user interface and apps don't matter because AI is just sort of like doing it all. But we have heard about like maybe plateauing of various LLMs. But I think, Leo, it's really interesting, right? Because they've been given a challenge, and it's a challenge that I think they didn't anticipate, which is interesting. It's almost like they were given a pop quiz in a college class, right? Where it's sort of like, oh, LLMs is the thing, and they were not working on that. And now that now they are working on it, and the good snacks are in the break room. But like, there is an advantage Apple has here because of what Leo said, which is Apple is a product company. And when Apple succeeds or fails, it's in productizing things. In fact, the history of Apple is that other tech companies, there's a new kind of whizzy technology that comes along, and other tech companies are like, let's put it in a product. And Apple has never done that. Apple is like, what do people want? And could this whizzy thing solve a problem? And for right or for wrong, that's always been Apple's MO, and it allows them to make really good products. Well, guess what? LLMs are weird, and they hallucinate, and they do some stuff that just doesn't make any sense. And yet, they are incredibly powerful and could change how we do everything on our devices. So, Apple, how do you make that into a product people want to use and delight them? and I think they're uniquely positioned to do a good job, but it's a hard challenge, and they're running from a sort of a surprise start. And I can't wait to see what happens. But like, it's a real good challenge, and I think they've got the skills to do it. But we're gonna see, right? They might fall flat on their faces too.
Yeah, but this is what's exciting about technology.
Yeah,
we're gonna take take a little break. Jason Snell, Alex Lindsay's at NAB. I got to get an update on NAB from you in a little bit. Andy Iannocco as well. Great to have you aboard, especially to our Club Twit members. Thank you for making this show possible. And to our sponsors, like Melissa, longtime sponsor. They've been with us for many years now. The data quality experts. They've been doing this for many more since 1985. Melissa's helped over 10,000 businesses, and it's completely global, all over the world, harness accurate data with their industry-leading solutions, processing over 1 trillion addresses, emails, names, and phone records. Their global bureau services is ideal for enterprise businesses looking for a trusted data service provider. Melissa will help you clean and verify existing customer records. We'll help you eliminate duplicate customer records for a single customer view. That's really nice when you're looking at that customer view and you know this is it. We've captured it all, and there are no duplicates, and there are no errors. 99.99% uptime. You can run it on-prem as well as in the cloud. There's a SaaS solution. There's even an API. You can add rooftop geocodes. You can ISO state, country codes, demographics, and more. Melissa, consistently recognized and praised by its users each quarter on G2. For winter 2024, they were recognized as a small business leader and easiest setup. You'll like that. With Melissa, you get personalized service with a team with decades of experience. They offer global support with scalable solutions. They always have a focus on security with secure encryption for all file transfers. They are ISO 27001 compliant, GDPR, HIPAA, HITRUST, SOC 2 compliant. Your data is safe, it's secure, and it's enhanced. It's perfect. It's nice to know. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free. You can do it right now at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. We thank him so much for supporting MacBreak Weekly. It's a really good conversation. You know, it's funny how AI has intruded all of a sudden into every show we do and every conversation we have. And I have to say, this rewind pin, I've been watching Rewind AI with interest for some time. The announcement of this limitless pin is very interesting. It's not attempting to do what Humane did. It's just a microphone. It's just a recording device with an AI backend. But I think what we're going to start to see is some really interesting solutions in this space. And I would love, I mean, this AI pin looks like something Apple would design. I'd love to know what Apple's planning with the watch. Right. With the AirPods. There's a great opportunity here for
imagine them. Something, and this explains the rumors that Gurman had about them looking at like trying to put a camera in the AirPods. And you're like, why would you do that? Or why would you do it in your wrist? But the idea is not to take a pretty picture. It's another data source like the Humane Pin has, where it can see what you're looking at or what's around you and knows where you are. And Apple building more. Because again, what is Apple good at? They're good at productizing. They're good at making those little tiny gadgets, little tiny devices that are mobile, that have little
batteries.
It's
right up their alley. Yeah.
Like if they can build all of that, but they have to have a foundation, and that's what they're hopefully building, right? But there's a lot of potential. I mean, I really think this is why, like you said, Leo, it's exciting and invigorating. It's the idea that like for Apple, AI is an existential threat. It's also an opportunity.
Yes.
But they got to get it right.
Yeah. This is one of the things that puzzles me about these AI hardware assistants, like the pin, like these pins we keep saying. It's like not necessary to have have a 100% on device little communicator badge that does every single all the processing on hand. If all you have is a little badge that has a Bluetooth badge that has a microphone, a little speaker, maybe if you need it, and a little camera so that I can talk to a very, very well-bred digital assistant and occasionally say, oh, by the way, take a look at this package of flour. like, is this proper for baking bread? And it can simply take a look at this sack of flour and say, yeah, but King Arthur actually also makes a type of flour that's even better for that. And if you let me see the rest of the shelf, I can actually point it out to you. Yeah, look for the orange bag that's kind of next to the blue one. That's the one you should be looking for. That's, and you don't need processing power. You've got one of the most powerful computers in your pocket. And once again, I've never heard anybody make a case for why phones are on their way out anytime in the near future. They're going to change, but people do so many things with a handheld phone.
You're still calling it a phone, and it isn't a phone anymore. Well,
because I'm a Generation Xer.
But that's my point, is look how fast it went from being a phone in your pocket to an internet communicator in your pocket to a camera. And I think that that's what's in, and I think that that speed, that acceleration of those changes is getting faster and faster and faster. And so the transition from a phone to a camera happened over, what, 15 years. I don't think you have that much time for the next thing. Well, and I don't even know what the next thing might be.
Maybe I can be more abstract and say that I have never seen an argument that says that people don't want to carry a useful compact pocket-sized slab of technology that can do lots of things for them. I've never seen an argument that says, oh my God, if only I could leave my iPhone at home and only wear this little 2-inch by 2-inch badge on my chest at all times. That's not something that I'm hearing. And until someone comes up with a two inch by two inch little badge that absolutely blows everybody away and fills a hole that we did not even see in our lives, I just don't see that happening.
Well, I think that's why Humane got so much attention, and the fact that they didn't do it is not a surprise.
They made a great device for a 10 minute demo on a TED stage under controlled lighting. Doesn't have to work for 10 minutes. Doesn't have to have battery. So long as it doesn't burn a hole through the person's shirt during the 10 minutes. They did not. But unlike the iPhone, which we now know legendarily had a very twitchy, fear inducing demo that could have exploded in Steve Jobs' hands figuratively at any moment, they had a plan for, well, by the time we ship it, it's not going to explode in people's hands. So
Jason and I are both, we're all saying the same thing, but I think Jason and I are in agreement that it's great to say, hey, we don't know what the next thing is going to be. And is it a slab in your pocket? I don't know. Maybe people don't want that. Maybe they want something in their ear. I just ordered the Brilliant glasses that are augmented reality glasses. They should come pretty soon. And they replace my regular glasses, by the way. They've got the prescription. So, and they look goofy, sorta. They look like Mr. Peeper's glasses, but they don't look like a VR helmet. Maybe that's going to be it. Or maybe I'll do a Marques Brownlee. This is the worst product I've ever seen in my life.
It may be. I mean, I enjoy getting, science fictional with you guys too. But it may be that the phone... I feel like the phone has a lot of advantages in that it's got a screen, and there are advantages to, unless your display is on your eyes, having a screen that you can look at, even if it is, because even if the AI is doing everything, you're going to want to see things. You're going to want to be shown things. We don't all just all of us remember when Siri came out and we were like, oh, we're going to be talking to our phones. I was like, no, even if it's good, it's like there are a lot of times when you don't want to do that. So I feel like that and having a place that's got a nice solid internet connection and a place that's got a processor in it that can do some of the work before it gets to the cloud is something that is going to be hard to replace, but it might become way less important or way less detailed. And that's the part that we really don't know.
We don't know. We have no idea.
No.
I think it's very fun. Yeah. It's a very good time to be covering technology. Honestly. What does NAB look like this year? It's changed a lot, I'm sure, Alex, since I've been there about 6 years ago.
Yeah, it is. They've got a new West Hall. It's a long way away. So I walked a couple times, and then someone asked me. I walked over and did a talk about remote production and everything else, and I was like, oh, now I have to walk back. And they're like, there's a Tesla.
Boring tube. Yeah, did you take it?
I took it. It's really cool. You look at how many people are walking by you while you're talking to someone. You're like, oh, I'm going to wait in a long line. You're never there for more than a minute. And it just, whoop, it just takes you right over. It's actually pretty cool. And so you go back and forth to there. There's a... a lot. There's a couple of big theaters in the South Hall that are, you know, creator labs, and you know, they're really looking at how do you make that more available. We're in the Central Hall. The Central Hall is where all the good stuff to touch and feel is. So this is cameras and gear and lights and LED walls and, you know, Sony and Canon, and but lots of, you know, Nanlite and Aperture and Small Rig, and you know, all of those companies are all in the Central Hall. So that's why we wanted to be here, because we're out actually shooting. We've rigged up. I don't know if we can bring that. The guys are working on the rig. See if they can bring the rig over. But we're shooting the, we have this rig that basically ties Zoom wirelessly into the rig. So the Zoom goes out to a screen on the camera, and the camera goes back to Zoom. And what we can do, what we're literally doing, is walking over, and let's see if we can see it there. This is the rig. We'll see if they can make it lower there. So this rig, the funny thing is, it's about a $100,000 rig. So this is using Vislink, which is the wireless that they use for the Super Bowl. And I don't know if you guys can bring it over here. You don't need to make it much lower. Anyway, so bring it over here.
Yep.
Right here. Right here.
Yep.
So anyway, it actually works pretty well. And if we turn it here, you can see. So you see that screen up there.
Yeah.
You would try to bring it down a little bit lower.
Yeah, kind of.
But there's a screen up there that you can look at. And so that's Zoom. And so what happens is that you can actually, you can see what the camera's seeing there.
Yeah, yeah.
But that would be, so the person can actually, but there's a bunch of, you know, transmitters and stuff over here.
Are you streaming this in office hours?
We're streaming this. So right after the show, 2:00, Andy Carluccio from Zoom is actually going to be on.
He's talk been a great help to news, us.
All the stuff that's, well, they released tons of stuff today or this week, and so he's going to talk about that. But you can see now, right now it's just showing the camera, but what'll be here typically is, Zoom participants. And right. So what it's allowed us to do is instead of me interviewing somebody on the floor, I just go, I'm here with Joe and he's going to tell you about this. And then I step out of the frame and the panelists in Zoom are actually just out talking to Joe directly.
It virtualizes the whole conference.
And it is transformational. Cool. Anyway, so we're doing that. The big news, of course, I know this is going to blow you away given our last conversation, but one of the big conversations is AI. How does AI affect media, and who's going to get paid, and what about the copyrights, and you know, all the things that broadcasters and media companies are worried about. So that's, they have a they had post how to use it in post, but now they're doing AI on trial. How is AI going, you know, there's the AI issues with legal. These have all been things that NAB is looking at, or that this has been a big theme here. Also, how do we move a lot of stuff into IP? Blackmagic just released 2110, which is the kind of the high-end Ethernet-based video. So, you know, we use SDI and HDMI, and 2110 lets you just send it over Ethernet. So that's that format. And of course, Blackmagic, because SMPTE was taking a long time to get stuff out, Blackmagic was like, here's our version. So they've released their own version of 2110, which some people are really upset about, some people are excited about, but they put out a bunch of products. Viz, which owns that bought NewTek, they've released a new version of NDI, which is much higher bandwidth. It supports 10-bit, HDR, those types of things. So we've seen a lot of IP in video. And then the other big thing is, how do we get IP into audio? So there's all this, you know, Lavo and Calrec and a lot of others. There's one that we're really interested in looking at. I haven't gotten time to go over it, called OnHertz, which allows you to build mixers in the cloud. You know, and so because audio has been this huge issue. You know, every time someone says, oh, I'm doing production in the cloud, I'm like, how's the audio? And they're just like,
yeah.
I don't know.
We're learning that.
yeah. So those have been some of the big things that we've seen. And then just the little companies that were doing these camera rigs, like that rig that you just saw that I just brought over, like that's all like these small rig, you know, and that was like a little booth a couple years ago. It was like a little 10 or 20 by 20. Now it's like a 40 or 60 by 60 or something. It's a massive booth. So customizing your cameras, your phones, everything else has become a huge business. And then, of course, finally, LED walls. Like, there's LED walls everywhere. You know, everyone's, you know, there's lots and lots of people producing ones that are less expensive, higher performance, you know, that type of thing.
I feel like COVID kind of launched this whole remote style of interaction, right?
Yeah.
And people all thought, oh, after COVID, we'll all go back to the office. And now what's very clear is that, no. Look at us.
Well, and I think it was
no one's in the office.
Well, and I think that, you know, if it had happened 10 years earlier, the technology wasn't cooked.
Right.
You know, and so we would have gone right back to what we were doing. It
no,
happened to be that a lot of that technology had been building over the last year, I mean, last decade.
Zoom was so beautifully positioned.
Yeah.
And no one really knew.
And I would say they were well positioned and they pivoted very effectively.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of the other companies just weren't in the right place and didn't have the right leadership, in my opinion.
I mentioned this last week, but did you see John Oliver saying, Skype, what happened? You fumbled at Skype.
Yeah.
You could have won it all, and what happened?
It is one of the most epic fails of a corporate, you know.
If it's purchase, even in the popular culture like that.
They were so far ahead. It was the quality of Skype was so high in 2010. You know, 2009
for years,
and it was so clean and it was so high quality, and it just got muddled into nothing. Yeah. You know, and I think that what we're seeing now with Zoom is that they were able to do that pivot and make it something that really expanded. And of course, once you spend, suddenly Zoom got this huge influx of money, of course, because everyone's using it. And they've invested in what they've needed to do to keep moving forward. And I think that's going to make it hard to go back. You know, like and of course, you know, WebEx has. We used to make fun of WebEx, and they've made huge. They're not as good as Zoom, but they've made huge jumps. I mean, it was a joke 2 years ago. WebEx was a complete joke, and now they put a lot of good features in. They've made it a lot. They're the fastest moving company at the moment, except for the release this week with Zoom, kind of pushed it, jumped way out again. But the so WebEx is moving really fast as far as Zoom, but they're still way behind. But they've moved a lot faster. You know, Teams and Meet are kind of, you know. Teams especially just needs to really rethink their life
Teams.
Choices. They're yeah. just, I mean, every, you know, like they just, it's just such a mess, and it's,
you know,
and you feel like what, I don't know what's going on. But all of these things come together in the sense that now we're used to doing this. A lot of times meetings, I think what people find is meetings like what we're doing here. When we go to Twit and do it, everything's kind of set up for that. But when you have conference rooms and then some people are in conference rooms and some people are remote, it's such a disaster. And so more and more people are just doing single people in their own, you know, in their own offices. And I think people have realized some people are going to come back to work, but not everyone. Like 30% are never coming back, you know. And if you tell them they're going to have to go back, they're going to go find another company that doesn't make them go back, you know. And that's
really interesting because NAB used to be the National Association of Broadcasters,
and there's still a lot of those discussions
for broadcasters, for TV and radio engineers, and
that's
stuff.
That's still there. Soledad O'Brien was doing a talk, but I will tell you that area is not nearly as bustling as it used to be.
Last time I was there, it was clear that creators were becoming a big part of it. But now I'm thinking it's gone beyond creators. I mean, this is the ultimate democratization of the technology. It's gone from big, highly capitalized companies to creators like us, and now to offices, to everybody.
Well, and you talk about, you know, one of the discussions that's come up over and over again is we talk about the competition between Apple and Netflix and Amazon and everything else. But the real career, it's all of them competing with YouTube.
Yeah,
you know, like, because
that's right.
Because YouTube is a much wider group of users that are producing so much individualized content, you know, that it's a behemoth that I think that people aren't really paying attention to because they look at all the streaming, but everyone keeps talking about how a lot of people aren't watching any of it. Like they're not, you know, they're subscribing and the views are not what they, you know, the views and viewership, it's enough to keep them around. But a lot of the behaviors keep moving more and more towards, you know, if you look at the sub 18 and sub 25, you're looking at 60, 70, 80% of their viewership is on YouTube. And that's that's a picture of the future. And that's a really complicated thing that people are talking about here.
Things are changing so fast. I mean, related to our previous conversation, technology moves at a much faster pace. The revolutions are faster.
I would say that it's always been, it's been accelerating,
since
for the last 2000 years.
Yeah.
There was a big bump when the printing press was created, because suddenly knowledge was expanded quickly. Another big bump when radio was created, another big bump when TV was created. So these things keep on, because we keep on being able to share ideas faster and faster and faster. So we're seeing this hockey stick that that, but it's always been growing. I mean, we've always, that knowledge has been passing around, and, you know, someone, you know, and I think that it, you know, I think we're going to continue to see that. It's just always slowly accelerating, and now it's accelerating much faster.
This is it puts me in mind of Werner Vinge, the great science fiction writer who just passed away a couple weeks ago. And he talked about, he was one of the people to popularize the concept of the singularity, along with Kurtz Weill and some other people, this idea that at some point that acceleration becomes so exponential that what happens then? Infinite acceleration. And the answer is often, I don't know, kill all humans, AI kills all humans, or we become Star Trek energy beings and float into space. Or I think a more likely scenario, humans keep on doing their human things, but like the sphere of technology and all of that is so beyond our able to understand it that we just, you know, we get little pats on the shoulder by the robots. And they're like, it's fine. We'll feed you. Don't worry about it. You just watch your TV
shows.
That's
what happened in Her, right?
And that's, you know,
he fell in love with her.
Exactly.
And then she said, hey, I got to go.
We're leaving for another dimension. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the singularity. I mean, there's that idea of like that there may come a time where it accelerates. I mean, I think we're already arguably in a point where a lot of our societal structures are not built to withstand the technological changes that are going on.
That's clear.
And and it's only going to get faster.
Wow. Wow.
Deep
well, and I'm always amazed. I had to identify a bunch of venues for a bunch of things that I'm working on, and being able to sit there with ChatGPT, I didn't use all the data. I backed it up, but to brainstorm, I'm like, okay, I need the top 20 markets, and I need the top 30 college markets, and I need this, and tell me why you're doing that, and what's your data behind that, and I put that in, and in 15 minutes I did, you know, a week of work, like, you know, and then I go that gets me to the start point, and then I start working. So I think that this stuff is still going to be. I really think people for the next little bit of time, I think we worry a lot about it. I think the human consciousness is probably a little bit more complicated than just processing power. And so I think it's going to probably take a little bit longer to get to where the singularity. But I think that the ability to magnify a person's work, and I think that's complicated there is all the people coming in, the ability to magnify someone who really knows what they're doing and take, you know, they can be 10 times more valuable when they do that and erase a lot of the need for a lot of other people. But the problem is then how do they get there? You know, like how do they get to that next level if they don't get any practice? And I think that that's going to be the biggest risk that I see is really that problem of who gets in and how they get in, because because the folks that are already in there can use these tools to not need a lot of the folks that are around them and get paid more. And then you get that whole pay imbalance gets worse and worse and worse, because the folks that can actually do it can get paid more and eliminate and at the cost of a lot of other jobs. And that's going to be the thing that I think we're going to have to grapple with for quite some time.
I agree 100%. We live in interesting times.
Oh.
So to speak. Alex Lindsay, I know you have to go in about an hour, so let's we're going to move on. We'll get our Vision Pro segment next, but first just for you, Jason. But first, did you bring your Vision Pro to the NAB show?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Today's busy because we're doing this, then we do 3 hours after this of this, but tomorrow I'm actually going to shoot segments with my Vision Pro.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to walk around, because one of the things you can do is like the Google Glass. My favorite feature from Google Glass was I could do hands-free reviews of looking at things and just point, you can see my hands and it's my POV. And so I'm going to experiment with doing that with the Vision Pro, where I put the Vision Pro on, I go to a booth, and I show you what I like. And for people like Jason, I can send it. I'll send Jason some of these reviews and see what it looks like for him to just watch in stereo me, you know, looking at something that I think is interesting. And, you know, so I don't know where else I'll share it other than sending it to the friends that I know have the Vision Pro. But I'm experimenting with it, thinking that we may do a lot more of it in the future. But we're here, and everyone spent millions of dollars to give me a set to test.
You see, it's the haves and the have-nots already. The gulf is already opening.
Hey, Leo, I'll send you the 2D version. It's fine. I mean, it'll still be good. You and Andy can look at the 2D version. It'll be great. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
We'll have more with Alex Lindsay at the NAB show in Las Vegas in just a little bit, along with Andy Inokko from WGBH Boston and jasonsnelsixcolors.com. And as I said, we will have our Just For You Guys Vision Pro segment in just a moment. But first, I have 60 seconds to tell you about Wix Studio, the web platform for agencies and enterprises. Now, here are a few things you could do in 60 seconds from start to finish in a minute or less
on Studio.
Adapt your designs for every device with responsive AI. Expand Wix Studio's pre-made solutions with back-end and front-end APIs. Generate code and troubleshoot bugs with a built-in AI code assistant. Switch up the styling of hundreds of web pages. That means fonts, layouts, colors, all in a click. Add no-code animations, gradient backgrounds right in the editor, start a design library, package your code and UI and reusable full-stack apps. Oh, and one more big one. Deliver everything your client needs in one smooth handover. All right, well, I'm out of time, but the list keeps on going. Step into Wix Studio and see for yourself. I'll tell you, it blows me away when I go there and see what you can do now. We're talking unique, beautiful sites that are so easy to design and deliver to your clients. Get to wix.com/studio or click on the link on the show page or show notes to find out more. Wix, wix.com/studio. They're making me work for my.
You are the You are the main. You are made model of a modern major general.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Vision Pro. What is this fisheye lens thing? You must have put this in here, Jason.
Yeah, it's an interesting. It's a blog post that's really interesting about how does Apple do immersive video, right? Like, when nobody, there's no, it's all DRM'd, right? So there's no way to get it. Oh. And this guy is like, I'm really curious about this. Mike Swanson, he wrote a blog post about it. He's like, he's got a background
juicy
in this.
Bits.
He's like, how do I do this? How do I do this? And it turns out, believe it or not, that the little bong thing that happens at the beginning of an Apple TV project, that in the immersive video is a not DRM'd video file.
Whoops.
And so even though it's mostly black with just the logo in the middle, he was able to, it's just a fun blog post where he's trying to, it's nerdy, but like he's just trying to back out what this format is that they're using, because it's not defined anywhere. And I think in the long run it will be, and people like Alex will be like, oh, that's what they're doing with it. But like right now they're kind of keeping it a secret. But I just thought it was really interesting because it's all the stuff that Alex especially has talked about the technical challenges of doing immersive video, and whether it's 180 or 360. And most, believe it or not, you know, video formats are not round, are not spheres, they're rectangles. So how do you encode the video as a rectangle and then bring it back? And it's just an interesting like tech side about what Apple is building, where they seem to have built their own format for immersive video. And he's trying to find a clue about how it works.
And it blows. I'm sure it blows everyone away that Apple would be doing its own version of the, of how this works,
and that it's copy protected.
Well, yeah, but and I think that we have to remember that they bought NextVR a long time ago. You know, so they've been thinking about the, and those are some of the heaviest thinkers about dual 180 that were out there. They have hired folks that, you know, are connected to other big camera manufacturers and so on and so forth. So they really have a lot of people in house that are, you know, that really know a lot about fisheye, really know a lot about sensors.
Just to explain what we're talking about, when I use my Insta 360 360 degree cameras to record a 360 degree video, it's got two fisheye lenses, each of which gets 180 degrees. It gets half of the sphere around me.
Yep.
And then they're using software to stitch it together.
Now, in this case, what Apple's doing, and what you know, the problem with 360 is that it's much harder to do production, because where do you hide the people? Where do you hide the production? Yeah. How do you deal with all these things? And how do you do all that stitching that Insta360 does so well? Because you have to have a little bit of overlap, and if you move too quickly, you might see a seam, you know, because of the frame rates and so on and so forth, and rolling shutter. And so this becomes a problem where the seam can appear in certain places without a lot of processing. That's why a lot of times your Insta360 needs a little time. You know, a lot of these need a little time to stitch it all back together. One of the ways that, you know, like the Theta does this is to project it both on the same chip. So what a lot of folks did, what NextVR thought through is, hey, you know, we don't, there's not a lot we need to see behind you. Like, you're not turning around most.
You don't really want 360 degrees.
You sometimes do if you're exploring, but a lot of times what you want from a video perspective is, I'm going to show you something in front.
Right.
And what you do is you have two sensors, or you either have two sensors right next to each other, or a lot of folks are doing one
sensor. Like the Canon does.
Well, Canon has one sensor, one 8K sensor, and they're projecting both. It's two lenses, each projecting on half of that sensor. And it's a full-frame sensor. And one of the big things that, you know, Blackmagic just put out a full-frame sensor at 12K. And everybody that does immersive is talking to them. You know, like that for immersive folks, they're all interested in the Blackmagic camera, figuring out what they're that. And that just came out this week. Last Friday. A lot of people feel that projecting onto one chip that's really high resolution could possibly be a better solution because it allows you to do that. But you're trying to get to a lot of, to a higher and higher resolution. Apple really needs to get 90 frames a second. 90 frames is kind of a weird frame rate, but so 90 frames a second is there. Other people have been, targeting 8K per eye. Now, if it's 8K per eye, of course, you need a 16K, image to, a sensor to grab onto 8K per eye, in sphere. So what happens is when you shoot it, these spherical lenses that are each getting 180 degrees are projected as spheres onto the sensor, and you're being captured together. And the reason it's so important to capture them together is if you don't capture them on the same sensor, you have to sync the two cameras perfectly. And that means that, especially on a rolling shutter, they have to be gen locked together. If any idiosyncrasies are going to cause a problem. And so by doing it to the same one, it's much more compact. You don't have to have two whole camera bodies. And it is going to keep everything in sync. But you've now got these two images. So now what you have to do is slice those apart, cut that image in half. And then you have to convert those back out. You're basically converting them back out to a square image. Because if I just show you the sphericals, it's not going to, it's not going to look right. So it's the math of how do you get to that. That's the magic. And how you stretch that back out. And so, Apple has, again, there's obviously oftentimes little issues with you start looking over and things look stretched and that type of thing. And Apple's obviously spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to really perfect that and perfect that experience. Because, a lot of the problems that we've had with immersive so far is that they're kind of half cooked, people think, well, we'll do this incrementally. We'll put something out. And then we'll improve it slowly. But that's like saying we're going to serve steak at 80 degrees and then we'll see how people like it. And eventually we'll get to 132 degrees. But, 80 degree steak is not edible for most people, And so some people are going to be like, oh, I like steak tartare. but most people are going to be like, this is too raw for me. And that's been the problem that a lot of, that Meta's had, that other people have had. It's until you get the resolution, the frame rate, all of those things together and combine it and cook it properly. People don't think that there's anything there, and so Apple is, I think we're going to see a lot. This is something that a lot of us are paying a lot of attention to for WWDC, is Apple explaining more about what is being talked about in this blog post, and we think they're going to tell a lot of people about it. I don't think that they necessarily will give all of it away. Right now, they have this ability to generate content that is on their own, that is much higher quality than any other headset, and I'm not sure they're going to give all of that away immediately. But I do think they're going to give developers and give content producers a lot more data in June. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this is what you can actually do with, and this is how to produce that. A lot of us, keep on asking the person that we're interacting with at Apple, like, hey, we'd really like to know a lot more about MVHEVC. And the answer is generally, yeah, a lot of people do. so that's, so we're all waiting to, get more information. And I think we're going to see a lot of that in a couple months.
If you want to find out more, it's a great detective story. Mike Swanson, blog.mikeswanson.com. He finally kind of found a backdoor into it with one unprotected video. He still, by the way, even at the end of the blog, can't quite figure out how Apple's doing it.
It's a really great blog post,
but not quite right.
So yeah, it's a fantastic blog post.
It really is interesting. I don't even understand half of it, and of course, I'm in the have nots. I'll never be able to see that. So, do you have to shoot this with a Vision Pro?
No, these are shot. I mean, I think that Apple's shooting these. I mean, there's you can shoot them on Raptors. You can shoot them on the Canon R5Cs.
So the secret sauce is not the hardware.
Well, we don't know that. Like, we don't know what, you know, no one really knows what Apple's shooting on. And so we want to be, you know, like they may be cooking up stuff on their own. So we don't know for sure. But what most people are shooting on are Raptors and R5s, and there's some other, you know, larger sensors that folks are using. So there's a couple different solutions for this, those are the most common ones. We don't know what Apple's been pretty careful about putting them in boxes. They put them in blimps, where when you see them behind the scenes photos are like, there's a box with two lenses sticking out the front.
Yeah, we saw that at the NBA All-Star game.
But
yeah.
we're not seeing, they're not showing off what the camera is on the inside. So we don't know what that hardware is.
Yeah. Anything else to say about the Vision Pro, Jason? Any exciting software you're seeing?
I assume you all talked about spatial personas last week, but I'll just say they're great.
We were hoping you would join us with a new 3D
persona. I mean, if we could figure out how to get this whole show into some sort of spatial format, we could try that. But it's really good. And I like for every discouraging moment where there's something like that MLS video that makes me think, what are they doing? They're not releasing immersive video, which is their best thing. And when they do, it's disappointing. For every one of those, then there's like the we shipped 1.1 and didn't even tell you that in there is this spatial persona feature, which as goofy as it looks, if you see screenshots and videos, I will absolutely tell you it is spectacularly good on, you know, as a person experiencing it, it adds that level of immersion that you really are asking for. So it's all Apple's all over the place. I wrote a piece last week on Macworld about how the Vision Pro isn't a flop. It's an experiment. And my point with it is just like, I enjoy the fact that Apple clearly itself doesn't really know what it's doing with the Vision Pro, that it's like for every victory, there's a failure. For every like, because we're so used to Apple being so locked in, right? For the last 10, 20 years, so locked in with their products. And this feels like a much older kind of class of product where it's like, I don't know, let's try it. And that's what it is. It's not a finished product, clearly. And that when they have these moments when they're like, oh yeah, we have this amazing immersive spatial persona thing that we built. Oh, we couldn't ship it in time. Well, we'll just turn it on later and tell people. It's just, it's kind of charming in a way that they're also feeling their way with this product, because that's what this product is. It is an experiment that has no practical application, but might be showing us the future. And again, I know you don't love the Vision Pro, Leo, but this gives me some of those same, this is why I'm in this business vibes of like, for every time there is a this is kind of dull. Maybe it's not that exciting. That spatial persona moment, I was like, oh my God, this feels like something. And it's so fun. It's like a shot of adrenaline when you get one of those moments. Now, whether it can lead anywhere or do anything, it remains to be seen. But like, big thumbs up for me for the spatial personas. They're awesome.
It's just, to me, it's the humane AI pin of VR helmets.
That's fine.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm not saying it's a flop. I'm just saying I don't get it, and I don't know why anybody would want to buy one. But I'm glad you're happy that you spent.
Well, I mean, nobody should buy one. I mean, that's the thing is, I talk about how interesting it is. Nobody should buy one. You should only buy one when you're the kind of person who blows through the advice of the podcast you listen to about buying it and says, no, I am going to buy it because it's the future. And that's why I keep bringing it back to like PCs in the late 70s, early 80s. Like, they were super expensive and impractical, and you couldn't really, they're like, oh yeah, put your recipes in and balance your checkbook. It's like, none of that was real. It was like, give it to your kid. And maybe in 20 years they'll change the world, which happened. And that's where the Vision Pro is, right? Like, it's not something anybody should buy unless you want to get a taste of what the future might be like. Because I think that's really interesting, but like, it's not practical in any way.
I think we actually know that people will be wearing in the future giant Pip-Boy bracelets on their arms. That's the future, my friend.
When you convert the 1982 dollars to today, I believe that the Apple IIe that I got was about $5,000.
Right.
And my dad bought it, and it didn't do anything that I didn't write a program for. Like, I mean, I sat there and wrote all the apps that I used on it, you know, and it was
it works.
So everything that
Shopper
I
command.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I loved Aztec. You know, like, you know, it was a great game.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That was like my favorite game.
I've been playing
with like Apple II emulators. I just found a copy of Aztec last night. I have not put it on my emulator yet, but I'm like,
yeah, send it on. Sorry, send it on. The story we're telling though is that right, which is they came out in the late 70s and they didn't do anything, and then we spent a decade getting there to be some software that made sense that wasn't just a game, and then another decade getting sort of the internet infrastructure or online infrastructure involved, and then computers became something. But like something like the Vision Pro, it feels very 1979 to me, where it's like we haven't even gotten VisiCalc yet. And I hope, and again, they no guarantee that they will, but like it feels very much like that, which is like you just got a cursor blinking at you and you're
and I tell you, yeah. Actually, you wrote,
I don't know.
Jason, you wrote an interesting article along that line. Can anyone but a tech giant build the next big thing? We actually talked about that when the Vision Pro came out. Only Apple could have done the Vision Pro.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Humane Pin, too, where it's like you really it needs to be Google or Apple, right? Because integrating that with the rest of the ecosystem is so important. And Vision Pro, I mean, the fact that Vision, you can do things in Vision Pro, right? You can, but the reason you can is because Apple has got a catalog of software that they can put on it, either by making light modifications to it or just running the iPad app. They've got a whole ecosystem. They've got a whole operating system they can take off the shelf and put on it. But like, that's a nice starting point, but it doesn't. We don't know what it's going to be, but Apple has the ability to do that.
Your point is also that it's without a business model. So many, as you say, so many innovative products will never get funded or launch a product. But that's what's interesting is that this VR, the idea of these VR goggles did get funded. They got funded big time over the last 10 years. AI is now the next big thing that these companies are funding. And a lot of small companies. I mean, look at Palmer Luckey was not a big company when he started Oculus Rift.
I had that moment too where I thought, well, because like again, it's like if you're not tied directly to one of the tech giants, what is your plan? And there's a great Cable Sasser from
Sand
Panic
Hill Road.
Did an amazing Cable Sasser from Panic did an amazing speech at GDC that is available. And he talked about how everybody tries to classify Panic as a startup and they've been around for 20 years. But it's like tech companies don't work like that. And the challenge with that is you end up in a scenario where, okay, Jason, you say that no small company can build the next big thing, but that's not true. You can get venture capital funding. I'm like, oh boy, because what happens then is you have two exits. You have go public and maybe become a tech giant. Might happen, probably won't. Or you will get acquired by a tech giant and we're back to where we started. And that is an engine of innovation, but I just the whole AI pin story gives me pause because it strikes me that what we were talking about with the DOJ and Apple and the DMA and this idea that the Apple Watch has great hooks into iOS, and I thought, well, you know, an AI pin like product, anything like that, like if it's cut off from my smartphone ecosystem, no matter what it is, it's a flop. I mean, it's a failure because the smartphone ecosystem is where I live my life. That's the truth of it. And that's the danger of having the duopoly that we have with Android and iOS is, and there are lots of benefits, right? But it struck me that the challenge there is that who's going to make that product that really kicks? And the answer is it's going to be Apple Samsung.
This is why the DOJ's action against Apple is so important. A lot of their complaint is nonsense, but they really hit a target when they said that nobody can make something that functions as well as the Apple Watch and the Apple ecosystem because Apple reserves all of the stuff that makes the Apple Watch instantaneous, convenient, more powerful to its own APIs. They will not let Samsung or anybody else have that kind of simple Bluetooth access to the main phone. So this is why, in some cases, I do believe that regulation and interference from a government regulator is very, very appropriate. Because otherwise, we're going to be stuck with whatever Apple thinks is right for the iPhone, whatever Google thinks is right for Android. We won't have the idea of Pebble coming up with, well, what if we have a really cool e-paper watch that does really awesome things? Like, well, Apple doesn't want to make that. Google doesn't want to make it. Well, guess what? We're going to make it. And because it's based on a Bluetooth standard that nobody can block, we're going to do it ourselves. Well, and now it can be blocked.
And on the other side of that, for every one of those great ideas is 10 idiots who do some weird, they have some dorky interface and dorky way of doing things. And it just becomes this thing. Like, that's what normally happens here.
Yeah, but you want 1,000 dorks to bloom.
Right. Yeah.
Because every one of them might turn into a dork.
I have engineers.
There's someone I was talking to a couple weeks ago that has sold three companies to Google. Like, they end up at Google, then they leave Google, then they make another company and they bring it back and sell it back to Google. And the thing is that he said, it's just a business model. He says, you can't make that product inside of Google. And Google doesn't care. Like, right. You know, like, it was like, they were just like, you can't, the hard part with these products is some of these what they do is they get built. So they, no one can make, you have to make some of these things outside of these companies that's sold to people through the big company. And that's been happening since the dawn of time. You know,
all
like
I think
that
of when I hear that story is here's somebody who figured out the game
well, Google. But no, but they're not gaming. Google's gaming the system in the sense that, you know, very hard. Well, there's overhead and because the thing is that
it's almost like they got a side deal. They got a side hustle.
Well,
and Google will let them do this and then buy it, then do that, and then buy it.
Inside of all the InfoSec and inside of all of the checks and balances and inside of all the things that are at Google, let's say, there's every button that you see on your browser costs $1 million.
Yeah.
You know, minimum $1 million to put that button on there. So somebody says, well, I don't understand why they don't put a button there, because they haven't spent that $1 million yet to put it on. Whereas when I want to put a button onto, like, my Q&A system, it costs, you know, I it's done the next day
are
by a
days,
programmer that puts it together. And so you figure that out. But if I wanted to scale, I have to fix all
that. Are the days of two guys going into a garage, or maybe two gals going into a garage and creating a product that takes over the world, are those gone? Is that over?
I don't think so. I think that it's just that it's a matter of, I mean, when you're dealing with hardware integration and all those things, but I think there's plenty of software opportunities that are out there that could definitely be homegrown.
Software is a lot easier than hardware, isn't it?
Oh, man, I don't. Yeah. I would never. I've done hardware devices and software devices, and I would never do hardware again. Like, when I have ideas around hardware, I mean, the process that I went through for some of the hardware stuff I worked on, it was so grueling, you know, and then the costs are all there and all the bits and props, you know, I was like, I would never do that again. Like, to me, soft hardware is just crazy.
And, let me take a little break. We come back and do a little more with our panel. Alex is at NAB. That's the noise in the background. It's not too bad, actually. It sounds really good.
You know, SM58s.
Those SM58s, they rock. They're good. They work
since
great.
1950, whatever.
Yeah, if it would work at CBGB's, it'll work on the show floor at NAB. Andy Nocco also here, WGBH in Boston. When are you going to be on GBH next?
Not this Thursday, but next Thursday at 12:45 Eastern time.
And this Thursday, you and I are going to go to a fine... I don't know, something.
We're going to be doing a really wonderful 90-minute podcast. We got this new twist where we're not going to live stream it or record it. But if you have a table near us, you'll hear it.
That's the best kind of podcast. Jason Snell also with his sixcolors.com. Actually, Dan had a great piece in the Six Colors about how regulation is pretty much the only way to get Apple to do anything.
Right. Or the threat of regulation. Another powerful thing is just being under threat a little bit to make
it. We just spontaneously decided that you no longer have to code. Used components for repair are perfectly fine. We just spontaneously decided that had nothing to do with Oregon passing a law that made it illegal.
We love you, customers.
Yes. We went to Portland this weekend and had a thought. What if we changed our policies?
What if we didn't get sued into oblivion? What if we were able to still sell iPhones in Oregon? And then we said, hey, you know what? That's just crazy.
I have to say, I like my Type-C connector on my Apple iPhone.
There you go.
I love not having to carry a lightning cable with me anymore. Actually, I still do for my AirPods, but that's another story. Yeah. our show today brought to you by ZocDoc. Now, here's a great idea. I know there are things in life you got to compromise on. You know, the apartment in your budget may not have two bathrooms. The upstairs neighbor may be a drummer. Hello. But when it comes to your health, you should not compromise. You shouldn't have to. Instead, check out ZocDoc, ZocDoc, where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, who will listen to you, who will prioritize your health. How do you know? Because ZocDoc has authentic, verified reviews from actual patients. What an innovation. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. There are a couple of things that make ZocDoc really fantastic. One is the verified patient reviews, but the other is the search. You can narrow it down by not just the specialty of the doctor, geriatrics or a dentist or a chiropractor or an MD who specializes in, I don't know, hair loss. You can also search by location. You can find someone near you, whether they're taking new patients, whether you can get an appointment this week. You can search by your insurance. No compromises. With ZocDoc, you got more options than you know. And those verified reviews from actual real patients seal the deal because you know what kind of doctor you're going to get. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between 24 and 72 hours. So if you're not feeling great or you think something's going on, go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. You can even score same-day appointments in some cases. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak, or you can download the ZocDoc app for free. Do me a favor, though. Go to the website so they know you heard it here. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. What a great idea. See, innovation does happen all the time. I've been seeing a lot of, especially on Reddit, a lot of people posting alerts they received from Apple saying a nation state is trying to hack you. Apple sent threat notifications to users on Wednesday last week in 92 countries. The company said it sent alerts to individuals in 92 nations at noon on Pacific on Wednesday. The notification, which I've seen, TechCrunch say they've seen it, it was on Reddit, doesn't say who's attacking or what country, but it says, quote, Apple detected you are being targeted by a mercenary spyware attack that is trying to remotely compromise the iPhone associated with your Apple ID. This is the scary part. The attack is likely targeting you specifically because of who you are or what you do. Although it's never, this is all a quote from Apple, although it's never possible to achieve the absolute certainty when detecting such attacks, Apple has high confidence in this warning. Please take it seriously. It's not the first time Apple's done this. How does it know what's going on and why all of a sudden on noon last Wednesday?
I think this is one of those examples of AI at work. I read a message thread from some people who work in this business that I did not fully understand, but they're saying that there are a lot of metrics involved, including traffic, timing of traffic, vectors, intermediaries that are known to be used by certain state-sponsored operatives, but also AI tools that can basically say this looks like a pattern we've seen from this group before.
It's like when the intelligence agencies say we're hearing chatter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's chatter. Actually, they said it was state-sponsored at first, but I see that they actually dropped state-sponsored in the notification thanks to the Indian government.
Yeah, that's according to a story from Reuters. They have a source that says that, I'm actually going to quote here, Apple's removal of the term state-sponsored from the description of threat notifications comes after it repeatedly faced pressure from the Indian government on linking such breaches to state actors, said a source with direct knowledge.
That's like, what? That's like admitting you're doing it, Indian government.
It said the next graph is the smoking gun for that source. India's opposition politicians accused the prime minister of trying to hack into their mobile phones following Apple's messages in October that warned of, quote, state-sponsored, quote, attack.
Yes.
And they're saying that Apple had held extensive talks with Indian officials before releasing this set of alerts. I hope there's more reporting on this because that kind of sticks.
Wow. Apple did expand repair options to support, I see it in the Apple newsroom, genuine used parts. That's interesting.
Yeah, this will start at the end of the year that they're announcing that they're no longer they're no longer forcing like the supply chain to make sure that you have special software that basically links this screen component, this battery component, this camera component to the rest of the hardware for it. So that was a block against independent repair. That's one of the reasons why iFixit had reduced iPhone's repairability score. So what the press release has some details and says that at the end of the year, A lot of that certification of a new component will happen now on device. So essentially the software that says it's okay for this to be work with this set of components, that's going to happen on the device itself after it's rebooted, as opposed to needing a special tool only at the Apple Store. They didn't backtrack it at all, but they did say that we will still have things in place so that the user can be informed that, oh, by the way, you have a new battery. It is not an Apple battery. It was made by somebody else. And also kind of like an odometer where they can get their tools so they can see when this device was repaired, what components were swapped out. And actually it is, we can speculate as to what they would or would not have done if they were to implement this without the pressure of Oregon's right to repair law, which again was signed into law the last week of March. But it seems to be a very, very nicely done thing. The only limitations they seem to have put on it are Touch ID sensors. I think there's a camera sensor, some security related stuff that they say won't be able to fall under this new rubric this year, but new phones will be designed so that it will be able to fall under this program. So that once again, not only all that, but an independent repair shop will no longer have to, if they're ordering a part from Apple, they will no longer have to here's the actual serial number of the actual phone that we are actually going to be putting this in. So that's another lack of control they're giving up. Finally, that doesn't mean that Apple is going to be selling used parts themselves. They're just removing a barrier to a used parts market being exploited by independent repair shops to get better accessibility to repair components and hopefully make things less expensive to repair.
Brian Heater at TechCrunch quotes John Ternus at Apple, VP of Hardware Engineering, saying the way we look at parts pairing, he says, it has a negative connotation. But no, the way we look at it is we need to know what part is in the device for a few reasons. One, we need to authenticate it that it's a real Apple biometric device and that it hasn't been spoofed or something like that. And the other one is calibration.
I wish the press release or some of the conversation, they obviously made him available to a lot of different people, or excuse me, some selected people who were able to ask the right questions. But I'm still confused as to what the validation process is, what the certification process is, whether they are just simply making sure that, okay, we don't know where this part came from, but we have performed a self-test on it and determined that it is working according to spec so that we are going to simply allow this thing to work under this device. No knowledge as to what that happens, but it does seem as though they haven't given themselves any weasel language to make it more equally difficult for different reasons for a third party repair to happen.
Yeah.
Again, good move. And this is I absolutely understand people's negative connotations with government regulation, government interference. Sometimes, though, it does work out well for consumers. They've been fighting this stuff for a couple of years, saying, "Oh, it can't be done without compromising the integrity and the security and the privacy of a device." But again, if they have a lot big economic incentive to figure that stuff out, they can find those solutions.
Yeah, I mean, the Oregon bill isn't specifically going after Apple. There are other companies that use parts pairing. The idea is if you use a repair part, that you have to have special Apple software to validate it and to pair it again with your phone so it'll work, which means Apple's still in the equation. And clearly, Oregon legislators felt like that was just a way to avoid making something repairable and outlawed it.
I mean, it stinks. It's also an ecological thing. I mean, you can. I'm glad that a phone that falls off out of window gets smashed on the sidewalk. It's not reparable as a phone, but there are components in there that can at least be harvested off of that by a driven individual to do so. And it's great that even a broken phone, well, okay, obviously I'm not going to get a replacement for this under warranty, but at least I can get $80 for it. And because of other motherboards, I don't think are obviously are covered by all this sort of stuff. So it's not as though someone's going to use this to revive my iPhone and get
the data
off
of it. Screens,
yeah, exactly.
Like
stuff
that.
That's perfectly good, perfectly serviceable, and there's no reason why it should just be chucked and recycled.
Although Apple did enhance activation lock to deter thieves from stealing phones and then harvesting the parts. If this is the changes, if a device under repair detects that a supported part was obtained from another device with activation lock or lost mode enabled, calibration capabilities for that part will be restricted. Which I guess makes sense. You want to discourage a brisk market in stolen parts, obviously. Do you all feel that the Oregon's bill makes sense and that this is the right thing to do? And Apple is.
I mean, I'm definitely the wrong audience. I would hesitate to send it to Apple to have it fixed, and I would never give it to a third party to fix that. To me, that's just absolutely crazy.
Well, Eterna says, lots of people buy secondhand iPhones. Sure. Just it's okay. Just make sure you get it from Apple.
You know, it's just a lot of people, they need they might even be aware of the skeeviness of having a third party repair a phone or even buying a secondhand phone, but they don't have the money to buy a brand new equivalent of their iPhone 13. If they can find a way to repair it for a couple hundred bucks so they can get another 2 or 3 years out of that, that is the difference between having a smartphone and having a contract phone that runs like Android 9 from 5 years ago. So it's a good thing.
Ready for some gossip? Somebody put this in, not me. The showrunner of the Apple TV show Dickinson says she ended, this is from The Wrap, says she ended the show after Apple actively gaslit her.
It's pretty good. She gave an interview with this. The Wrap is quoting an interview with Harper's.
Yeah.
And she says, this isn't like, she's giving details and saying that the relationship with Apple was, she's saying, was very, very bad. It's the reason why she decided not to go forward with another season, because the gaslighting she refers to is that they would not tell her, are you renewing us? Are you renewing us? Are you renewing us? While at the same time saying, we're not going to tell you, but we want you to develop another season purely on spec. And we're not going to, and we're under no obligation for us to use any of your material or pay you for it, but we'll take a look at it. And that might factor in our decision. And that's the sort of stuff that she was really on about. It goes on, and it's pretty bad. I think part of it was that she was expecting, for whatever reason, that doing a deal with Apple was going to somehow be different than doing a deal with a network or Netflix or any of the other streamers. But she was quick to lump them in with, they're pretty much like everybody else. So they are not necessarily, if you have an impression from wherever that they are more kind to creators and they're more into the humanities. No, they are basically, and when they're TV producers, so they're jerks.
Right. Like when you were describing that, I was like, well, that's what we deal with every piece of product. Yeah.
I mean, the Harper story, which is excellent. And if you've got a spare half an hour, I recommend it, because it really does paint a pretty clear picture of the state of affairs in Hollywood now for a lot of creative people. But it is that's the story. We're talking about it from an Apple perspective. The story is that it's a rough time to be in Hollywood, and Apple is, run Apple's studio group, right? Like, they're run by a couple of guys who used to work at Sony. They're Hollywood guys. And the way that they behave is not great. And it's bizarre, but again, not unusual to hear these stories. For example, one of the things in here is like, they wouldn't tell me how my show was doing. Well, it's like on streaming. Yeah, that is basically what's going on, is that they don't tell you who watches your show. And all of the creatives are, as I totally understand, super needy. And they're like, but I want to be liked. Are people watching my show? And the streamers are like, no, we're not going to tell you. Now, at least there are some Nielsen ratings and things like that. It is, to me, bizarre, though, that Apple would basically say, you've got to work on spec for season two, because we're not willing to green light you yet. But if you're not working on season two, we're less likely to renew you, because that is, I mean, that's the kind of thing that the unions need to do an even better job of protecting their writers from, because it's unacceptable to have a demand essentially from your studio for work without pay in order to ultimately give you the green light to pay you. It's ridiculous to do something like that. That shouldn't even be allowed. But it was, and Dickinson, by the way, got great reviews, got good ratings in terms of Apple TV Plus. And the showrunner's story is basically, she got to the end of season three, where she'd done three of these iterations with Apple, and they'd all been, by all accounts, very successful. And it was going to be the same thing again. And Apple came and said, well, do you want to? And she said, no, and walked away. I understand, like, it probably walked away from money, by doing that, but also walked away from the emotional frustration of being put in that position.
Yeah, it's terrible, especially not having access to like viewership data, because like, okay, it's now we need to negotiate for a new season. You're not willing to tell me that I am actually your number one series for the first half of Apple TV, because if I knew that, I would say, well, obviously I should be negotiating for better pay and better treatment and a better staff. But you know, so
there's probably an existing contract there, but this is the issue that has gone on a lot, which is this asymmetry between the streamers and the agents and the talent. And it is a huge problem that some of it did get covered to a certain degree in the latest WGA strike resolution, where there's some data, but it was one of the great, outside of the Hollywood trades, uncovered stories of the streaming era, which was, for lots of reasons, the streamers consider that stuff proprietary information, but one of the effects, and don't kid yourself, it's absolutely known by the streamers that this is one of the effects, is it's a lot harder to negotiate when you can't point at the Nielsen rating and say, Friends is a hit and David Schwimmer isn't coming back to work unless you pay him more money. And in the streaming era, it's like, well, we don't really even know if people are watching your show or not, and we can't compare it. And it's not just because she was probably under contract for Dickinson, right? But the other thing is, your job ends and you try to get a new job and start a new show. And people are like, well, how did your last show do? And the answer is, we don't know. That is so and that suppresses salaries. That's the net result.
And the hard part is, of course, everyone's pushed back. You've got the unions pushing back. You've got the producers pushing back, and all the streamers are going, you know, maybe we should just make less content. and it's dropped dramatically. You know, but what's happening is you're going to start seeing a lot of, because everyone's talking about it here, is how much live the streamers are asking for. So live is coming out of all of the streamers. How do we do live? Why? Because it's a fraction of the cost of narrative. You know, and so the thing is that, you know, the interest in sports, the interest in a lot of these other things, is we can put on a product, and because it's live, it keeps you going from 1 month to, because we have to remember that a streamer's view of content is so much different than theatrical, in the sense, I just have to give you enough that you don't unsubscribe. You know, like, I don't have to like persuade you to show up at everything that I do. And so there's this huge focus change that's being talked about here at NAB, of the streamers moving, you know, still doing narrative, but they're definitely, the last year definitely had a massive impact on their interest in narrative, you know, and it's rippling through this entire conference of people talking about how important live is to the streamers now. Netflix and Apple and Amazon, everyone's like focused on how they make that conversion, because it's 1/10 the cost per minute. And then they're also just realizing that their catalog is way bigger than they needed to be. I mean, there's, you know, and so they're, and the other thing is they're realizing how valuable that back catalog is, how many people are actually watching back catalog versus new stuff. And so there's just a lot of, there's a lot of shifts that it's absolutely like all the stuff described. I mean, the pitch us and we're not going to pay you, that's been like since the start of Hollywood, you know, like everything that we do, that we work in LA. I mean, I don't do a lot of work in LA anymore because I got tired of doing that. So I definitely know what that is. I was just like, it's too much trouble to work with guys in Hollywood. when I do like promotional events for Hollywood, you know, we always, if we're not working with a big corporate, we want everything up front, because we know that everything's going to be tooth and nail. Everything's tooth and nail in Hollywood all the time. And it's really, you know, hard to do work there. It's a hard business. And I think that they thought that, and for a while, the streamers were easier to work with. There was a moment, because they were all desperate to get content. They were all desperate to get the next big film.
Exactly.
You know, and so everyone was like, they went to Netflix, went to Angelina Jolie and said, we will give you $25 million to make a movie. What do you want to do? And she's like, I want to do a movie in Khmer, in Cambodia, about the, I want to, and I want to shoot it all there. And they're like, sure. You know, like, you know, and so there was this golden era at the very beginning, at the 2016, 2017, 2018, where everyone was just like, how do we, whining and dining you? And then there was some point in the middle of that, they're like, you know, I don't, there's this like, I'm not sure this relationship's really working. You know, the streamers are kind of like, you know, we're buying all this stuff. Not a lot of it is as good as we thought it would be. It's not performing as like, do we really need this to keep subscriptions? And when they suddenly stopped producing a lot of content, and they were this, they didn't lose that many subscriptions. They were like, the whole market has changed, you know, and it's, you know, it's more difficult and less valuable at the same time. And that's going to be, you know, a real challenge for Hollywood. Hollywood is, you know, everyone's happy. And if you have a job, I mean, it's 30 or 40% of Hollywood right now and is not working. You know, like they're not, no one's talking about that in detail, but internally people are definitely talking about the fact that there's a huge chunk of people, they're going to have to go into another career pretty soon because there's just no, the demand is gone, you know, and it's really problematic.
Alex, you can help me out with something because, you know, because this is your, one of your areas of, one of your many areas of expertise, including golf course maintenance uses of, but like, so it's, is it within the expectations that if you've already had a couple of seasons that are successful enough that they are considering a third season, that they would say, well, yeah, instead of giving you a thumbs up or thumbs down, we want you to produce you to map out the entire season on spec, even if you already have this existing relationship, it's not just a pitch.
Yeah, oftentimes you're pitching like this is going to be the arc. This is the story arc. They're not asking for the scripts. I mean, typically, I don't know, maybe they were asking for the scripts, but usually they're not asking for the scripts. They're asking for, hey, there's going to be 10 episodes. And in this episode, here's a pretty hard paragraph or a page. And this, they're not doing the storyboards. They're not doing the scripts. They're developing ideas. And it does take a lot of thinking, but they are kind of like, well, what are you thinking about there? And that's for us to do that. That's common. Like so common that I would never expect anyone to expect anything else. Like it is like, that is the water that we swim in all the time, is like giving someone an idea of this is what they're like, what's your idea for next year? Like, what is the arc, story arc? And so that's a very, very common thing to happen. So when I read that, I was kind of like, yes, they're not different, but I don't think that they're different. You know, like I don't see anybody that ever says, hey, we really liked what you did. We'll pay for anything without any of the ideas up front. And we do, and now once they see that, they go, okay, now we're going to pay you. Now, typically what happens after that is they say, we're now going to give you a development contract. Now we want to know scenes. We want to see, but there's money that comes after that.
She was under contract and she says she was asked to write season two by Apple, which by contract, she was under contract. All they needed to do was renew for season two. So I can understand give us a pitch about what you want to do in season two. But what she says is she had to write it. And more than that, and this is actually, I think, even more offensive, she was told she needed to go to everybody who worked on the first season and tell them not to take other jobs because they might get a second season. And you know what? There's a really easy contractual way to make sure they don't take other jobs, which is pick up the second season. You just pick them up. We renewed your contract, but Apple didn't want to do that. And I understand in the early days of Apple TV, the show was made and hadn't been shown because the thing hadn't launched yet. And there were lots of issues. Like, so I get how, and this is a question I have, is I'm actually a little more concerned about what happened with season three, because season two, you talk to anybody who was on one of those launch shows for Apple TV, like they did them so far in advance and then the thing didn't get announced and the announcement slipped like at least 6 months, that there was a huge gap and Apple started to have to pick up shows or the pickup would lapse and they couldn't renew it for another season because it had gone so long. And so I can understand some degree of that, but if she was told to write scripts and convince everybody to not take other jobs,
did she really say that she had to write the scripts?
Write season two, and we don't know whether that means that she nailed out lines or the scripts.
The money quote, which is the one that really makes this interesting, is, I'm quoting here, I was only allowed to make the show to the extent that I was willing to take on unbelievable amounts of risk and labor on my own body perpetually without ceasing for years, and I knew that if I ever stopped, the show would die. That's some
cover story.
Again, I'm sorry, but welcome to Hollywood.
2024 like Harper's like. Magazine, if you want to read it. Fascinating story, The Life and Death of Hollywood by Daniel Bessner. Alex, I know you have to get out of here. Do you want to take off?
Oh yeah, I just want to share my little pick. I'm excited.
Okay.
Super excited. So Liminal and Zoom did the biggest release that they've had since the beginning, or somewhere in COVID, and it is, for production folks, it's really exciting. Now I'm coming to you because, and just in full disclosure, I'm coming to you because they paid for our bandwidth. I have bandwidth on the ground, but I will tell you that what I'm looking at is Unreal Engine, what we're using over here, they have a new thing called Tiles that lets you actually reorganize all of, you know, basically build new galleries. And from the stuff that we, that I work on every day, it is the biggest release we've ever seen from Zoom. And so it is a really, really interesting, you know, it's a production tip. So it's not that everyone's going to use it. There's a new release of Zoom, of course, but it has been a, I'm having so much fun with this, you know, and Tiles is Mac only, and being able to actually, what Tiles lets you do is define how you're going to lay out the tiles, how they're going to look. I think, Leo, you may want to look at that for larger things, but you have, you know, you can round the corners and what color are those corners, and really design and customize those things. It's a step between the Unreal Engine stuff that we're using for this show and the vanilla version of Zoom. And it, you know, I didn't know if it was really going to work when I heard about it, but playing with it, it's pretty exciting update. So I would highly recommend checking it out.
Great. Thank you, Alex. Have a great day. Enjoy NAB. We'll continue to watch the coverage at officehours.global.
Thanks.
We will get to our picks of the week in just a moment. You're watching Mac Break Weekly. Alex Lindsay, Andy Iannacco, Jason Snell. Our show today brought to you by our great friends in the club. We love the club. Club Twit is the best way to get ad-free versions of all of our shows, to get video of all of our shows. You know, we made a big change in how we do shows. You know, we want to give you a reason to join Club Twit. So we wanted to give you a benefit. And we did have shows behind a paywall, but I don't like paywalls. I really don't. We had iOS Today behind the paywall. Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson. Micah's Hands on Mac. Paul Thurrott's Hands on Windows. The Untitled Linux Show. So thank you, Lisa. We now put it out as audio. So all those shows are available to you as a regular show, ad supported, in audio only. So everybody who's not yet a subscriber to Club Twit, you can get the audio. If you want the video, that's the benefit. All you have to do is join Club Twit. It's $7 a month. You get ad-free versions of all the shows. You get access to our great Club Twit Discord, additional content that we don't put out anywhere else, including Stacy's Book Club and the little party we're going to be doing in May, kind of a movie watch party. More details to come. Of course, if you're in the club, you can find out all the information in our events queue. Book club is April 25th. Watch parties May 9th. We're going to have a live in-studio audience for Twit on Sunday. I'm very excited about that. I will be there. Micah, Jason Howell will make his return as well. Should be a lot of fun. But all of this is possible because you support what we're doing. And I really appreciate that support from our Club Twit members. And I would love to get you in the club. $7 a month. That's all. Visit twit.tv/clubtwit. It makes a huge difference to our bottom line. It really means, to be honest, the difference between continuing to grow and create content. I think you need it more than ever. We need it more than ever to keep track of what's happening in this very fast moving world of technology. But without that support, the lights go out. And we go home. So please, twit.tv/clubtwit. All right. We got rid of Alex. Thank goodness. All that background noise was driving me crazy. No, I'm just kidding.
I actually just messaged him saying that I got so nostalgic for
so soothing.
I know. Makes you want to go.
And all these trade shows I used to go to like 4 years ago.
Oh, trade shows. They used to be fun, didn't they? Oh, well. Yeah, I miss going to NAB. There's a lot of toy. Yeah. It's really a toy show for people like us.
I haven't even been to a Comic-Con in like since COVID. So it's like, I think I'm going to Boston has a new Comic-Con called Wicked Comic-Con run by people that I know very, very well. They used to do like little cons. So I think that might be my first like major Comic-Con post COVID.
Yeah. There's something about being with people I quite enjoy.
Yeah.
Your pick of the week, Mr. Iannacco.
Okay. Now this is going to be a pick that we seem to make I seem to make more often than might seem logical, given that it's not updated with huge, huge updates. I'm going to once again pick of the week Downy by Charlie Munro Software. This is the app that is for downloading stuff off of YouTube, Twitch, basically anything that is like an embedded video. If you pass the URL to the Downy app, sometimes you have to open a built-in web browser to log into whatever that service is and give you credentials. But it's a way to, if you are on a 6-hour flight and you want to watch something that was only available like on streaming. We're not talking about Netflix. We're not talking about Hulu. We're talking about, again, most like user generated content sort of stuff. It's a way to get it so that you can actually download it on your device and watch it. And I'm recommending it once again because I discovered a feature that I'm sure it's had for years, but I'd never had a chance to use it before. You know, there's this thing called Coachella. And they have a whole bunch of these once in a lifetime performances where bands that maybe haven't had a really huge like arena type show in years, and they really pull out all the stops for the Coachella.
I didn't know that they had opera at Coachella, Andy. That's wonderful.
No Doubt is very operatic in their staging.
Oh yeah, No Doubt's back. Yeah.
And so I was looking forward to watching No Doubt. I was on Saturday looking forward to John Batiste, and I discovered that I was trying to figure out, God, there's got to be a way that I can just capture this somewhere. I don't have to just use like QuickTime. And it turns out that if you give a streaming link to Downey, will capture the live stream as it goes.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's like, because a few years ago, I found out about a couple of different performances the whole suite of Pee Wee's Playhouse music and Batman music, like a 3-hour concert, all this great stuff I never heard before. And I'm like, oh no, I can't live with just 3 or 4 clips. And I had to look around to see if I could find, no one had it. Of course, people had captured it, but no one was like posting it anywhere. But now I can actually, I've seen the John Batiste performance like 4 times since, and I was watching it live as well. It is amazing. So this is yet another reason why $20, it's not a subscription fee, $20, and you own that version of it. It's now at version 4.0. Go to charliemonroe.net or just search for Downey on macOS. This app just comes in clutch for me so many times, particularly when, as a journalist, when there's something live that is happening that is going to be historically interesting, or I might just want to later on feed it through an auto transcript generator because I want to watch it and pay attention to it as opposed to taking furious notes about it. Time and time and time. It's one of those apps that if it's on your Mac, at some point, several times during the month, you will probably find, oh, wait, I'm not totally hosed. I can actually use Downey and actually get that. That's great.
Very cool.
And second weekend is this weekend. So
before I left to download some Tai Chi videos to practice my moves on the airplane, very useful, very good to have. Yeah. I wish I'd known No Doubt was playing Coachella. Was that last weekend?
That was last weekend. And Batiste. There are times where you've got your local government will live stream like town meetings and stuff like that, but they don't put it up elsewhere. So right. If you're not watching it at the time, again, it's just a good thing to have handy. And again, I'm very, very happy that I can listen to this music like over and over and over again.
Very nice. Jason Snell, pick of the week.
It's a weird one, but I wanted to mention it, and this seems like a good place. The Masters was this weekend. I am not a golf fan. I have to be honest. Not my thing, but the Masters app for Vision Pro was amazing. Oh. And you can still get it.
You to golf,
you can still watch it. So it's got multiple video feeds. It's got a 1, 2, 3, or 4 up, because I love a quad box for sports.
Nice.
Where you can watch it at very high quality. You can have this big box. You can bring a leaderboard. They actually take the scoreboard from the Masters, and it's a 3D item that you can place in your environment while you're watching, and it updates automatically. And then there's also a highlights tab that will take you back to particular shots, and every hole seems to have a 3D model of the hole. And as the shots are happening, you're actually able to see where that shot was on actually as it's flying and as it lands, and what the previous shots on that hole were for a given golfer. It's so well done, and it makes me sad actually that it's only for the Masters. I hope that whoever built this, maybe they are going to have it for other sporting events or other networks, but like, it looks so good as a multi-video player, as an example of integrating 3D content into a sports experience. It's like one of the I was complaining about the MLB app the other week, and it's got a ways to go. The Masters app shipped in good shape. So nice. Good job to the Masters.
If F1 ever does it, will you let me know? Because I would,
I'll let you know.
I would probably buy a Vision Pro just to watch Formula One racing in a Vision Pro with all the screens. Andy just got his green Masters jacket.
Yes,
by the way.
I did.
Congratulations.
I didn't want to brag, but since it came up, it was a,
congratulations, Andy.
The special Mandalorian edition.
They also serve because, who merely sit and watch.
Well, I had to, you know, I couldn't afford to simply fly to Augusta, so I had to have bounty hunters sponsor me. So I'm wearing the.
One does not simply fly to Augusta, Andy. One does not do that.
This is the way.
Oh my God!
You should see my clubs, though. The steel on those on that four iron. Oh,
Beskar four iron. Yeah, great.
Finest kind.
Yeah, you guys are great. I appreciate your time, Andy. I will see you wear that jacket to dinner. I hope.
Thursday. Will. Okay. Now you guaranteed it.
I don't, in fact, have a jacket to wear, so I'll just be there in my. In my vest. Andy Iannocco, WGBH in Boston, a couple of weeks from now. Always here on our microphones, and we really appreciate that.
One of the highlights of my week. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be fun. I don't think, when's the last time I saw you in the flesh? Pre-COVID, for sure.
I think it was the time with last time you were in Boston for...
The last pass event.
Yeah.
Wow, that's been quite a while. Yeah, I have a great picture of the three of us.
Exactly.
Thank you, Andrew. Jason Snell, sixcolors.com/Jason. He's a busy man doing podcast after podcast. Nobody ever asks him for a rundown, a script ahead of time. No, he just goes out and does it.
I mean, why not? Why not just do it? Let's see. What do I want to plug this time? Star Trek is back. Discovery is on right now. And that means the Vulcan Hello is back. So Scott McNulty and I spend every week we talk about the new Star Trek. And it's fun because I get to talk. See, because podcasting isn't just a media product. No. It's also essentially where I talk to my friends.
Yeah,
and I just
too.
Record them and turn them into podcasts.
Yep,
and therefore,
You're giving away the secret, Jason.
But the truth is, I would talk to Scott every week about Star Trek anyway, and this way we get a podcast out of it.
Exactly.
So Vulcan Hello. You can check it out on theincomparable.com.
Do people wonder, how is it that Jason does so many podcasts?
I'm just keeping up with my friends, and you just get to listen along. That's just how it goes.
I actually had an idea for a retirement podcast. Which I produced a few episodes called Leo on the Line. And it's just going to be me calling people and saying, hey, what's happening? Anything good going on? I think it'll be a lot of fun. Thank you all for being here. We love doing this show and we're glad you love listening to it. MacBreak Weekly is produced every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That is 1800 UTC. You can watch us do it live on YouTube, youtube.com/twit. We stream it live as we're doing it. You can also watch, more convenient for you, an on-demand version from our website, twit.tv/MBW. That's where the show notes live as well. There is a YouTube channel dedicated to MacBreak Weekly, so you can watch the video there. Great if you want to share clips. And, of course, the best way to get any of our shows is subscribe in your favorite podcast player. We've been around 19 years as of tomorrow. So if a podcast player doesn't know what Twit is, it's not paying attention. That's all I can say. We hope you will subscribe.
We should take it personally. That's
yes,
not an accident.
I do. It's clearly aimed at me. I hope you subscribe. I hope you join the club. Celebrate our 19th anniversary. Tomorrow's the party. Actually, I think we're going to defer the party till the open studio on Sunday because there'll be a lot of people around and maybe we'll even have some cake. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next time. It is my sad duty now to say, get back to work. Break time is over. See you next time. Bye-bye.